It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
And Texas showed up in a big way this week on Wednesday night and again on Friday. Can they bring that same energy tonight? I hope so. This is episode 713 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, July 18th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. I am the God of War, the God of Thunder and Lightning, the God of Grey Goose, and the God of... I don't know. I lapsed into Chris Jericho there for a second. I apologize. But this is Money in the Bank Sunday. And we are going to talk about Money in the Bank, including predictions. And I also watched the Impact Slammiversary show last night, which I was not originally planning on doing. So I am going to have some thoughts on that as well. But let's take care of business first. And I want to give a special thank you to everybody who dropped some PayPal love to the podcast this week to show their support. You may do so if you would like to on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out, including these fine folks here. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, dropping some love. Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, Big Bear, Bryant Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, Massgrave, Micah Harshaw. Hope Micah's doing well. The Moldovan Masochist, Alexandru Mata, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Ostentatious Alan Carter, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, Michael Maximum Pain Palkowski, and the Pastor of Pain, a lot of pain going around this week, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell. Philip and his wife, I want to give them a shout out because they run a YouTube channel called My Slotty Obsession. And before anyone's mind goes to the gutter, they post videos of their high limit slot play from various casinos throughout the United States. And it's perfect for those who have short attention spans, who are just looking for a quick hit, because all of their videos are under 3 minutes. And most of them are only about a minute long. No fancy graphics or production, just high-limit slot play. All you gotta do is type My Slotty Obsession into the search bar on YouTube, like, and subscribe. They post new videos daily. Philip has been a diehard listener of the podcast for over 12 years now, and I want you guys to show him some love. And the other thing I want to mention here is that this Wednesday, when I am live after AEW Dynamite, as I am every Wednesday on YouTube, I'm going to be doing a ticket giveaway contest. Not doing it, but hosting it on behalf of WrestleRumble.com. And this is something you're going to want to get in on. I know a lot of people, when I mentioned it last week, were very excited. We are going to be giving away two tickets to AEW All Out in Chicago this September. These seats are dead center opposite the hard camera. They are section 116, row 2, if you want to look at a seating chart. So you can sit with Mr. Wrestle Rumble himself, Matt, and his crew. Food and drinks are on the house. So not only do you get two badass seats, but you can wine and dine like kings and queens, as somebody once said. The cutoff time for entry into the contest is Wednesday at 8 p.m. when Dynamite goes live. So if you tried to get tickets to All Out and you missed it, or if you're thinking about going, this is a great opportunity for you to get in on. So go to WrestleRumble.com and send in your entry before it is too late. Now, I mentioned that I watched the Impact Slammiversary show last night. First time in front of live fans in nearly 500 days. Thank God, because those shows in the empty impact zone before they started piping in noise were unwatchable. I would tune in occasionally and it would just be an empty room with not even background noise. And I couldn't even watch it. But I knew Kenny Omega was defending the Impact World title against Sami Callihan, and I thought there was a good chance that we might actually see a title change, so I said, what the hell? Let's watch this show. So this is less of a review and more just some quick observations I thought I would go through here based on what I saw last night. This was the first time that I've seen an Ultimate X match in many years. I don't know how many of them they still do, if they do them annually or not. Obviously, they used to be a really big deal in the old TNA days. I haven't seen one of these, though, in a very long time. There were some pretty creative spots that I haven't seen before. Josh Alexander, he is the X Division champion. He retained his title. I guess Hawkins and Ryder, they've been feuding for months in Impact. Or Brian Myers and Matt Cardona, I guess I should say. So Myers brought out Tennille Dashwood as his partner, Emma, who used to date Cardona. And Cardona brought out his real-life fiance, Chelsea Green, as his mystery partner, making her Impact Wrestling return. No more Laurel Van Ness, although she was sort of acting like Laurel Van Ness, but she's going by Chelsea Green now. I mean, she may as well. Everybody knows her under that name. It was the likeliest landing spot for her with Cardona working there. And also given her history there, she got the biggest push of her career. She made a name for herself working for Impact, doing that hot mess character. So really, Impact was probably the best fit for her. I thought it was nice to see Big Cass getting a second chance. He's going by the name W. Morrissey, right? Is it for William Morrissey? And he's getting a second chance, big singles push right now in Impact. He had hit rock bottom in his life. And if you've never seen the interview he did with Chris Van Vliet, you should watch it. It's a pretty rough story, but he was very candid about the things that he had gone through, battling addiction, at the end of his WWE run, post-WWE. But he also, I have to say, has the worst case of backne that I have seen since Gene Snitsky. Holy shit, dude. I know he's in great shape and all, but whatever you're doing, dial it back a little bit. Because in HD, that stuff is just popping out at you. You can't not notice it. Moose. Gotta talk about Moose. Moose had a match against Chris Sabin. This match made me scratch my head so much, I think I drew blood. Chris Sabin is a very good wrestler. And let's just get that out of the way first. No one is denying the fact that Chris Sabin is not talented. And I admit, I have not been following the story between these two week to week. But the last time I watched Impact this closely, earlier this year, Moose was on fire. That was when he replaced Alex Shelley in the six-man tag at their Hard to Kill pay-per-view against Omega and the Good Brothers. The man was doing fucking Spanish flies off the top rope and things a man of his size should not be able to do. It felt like he was on the verge of being their next big breakout babyface. And I thought they could have Omega drop the title to Moose when the time was right. And then, of course, they did the match with Moose and Omega at Daly's Place and he lost. But it wasn't the right time for him to win anyway. And Moose re-signed with Impact last month, I think, after teasing that he might leave and go to WWE. And he even admitted after the fact he had interest from WWE, but he decided to stay with Impact. Now I tune in and I see Moose, who felt like one of the hottest things in the company a few months ago, losing to Chris Sabin. To a roll-up. A victory roll-up. That's what I'm going to call it. It was a victory roll, but I'll call it a victory roll-up. It's like, what the hell happened? Since I last saw that version of Moose, what has happened? Why is he being rolled up by Chris Sabin? I thought that was very dumb. Very, very dumb. No Way Jose debuted in Impact. Now he's just No Way. Very original. Although when he was introduced, Falaba called him No Way Jose. So that might have been a little botch on his part, a little Falabotch. They were partners in a four-way for the Impact Tag Team titles, which are now back around the waist of the Good Brothers. Thunder Rosa showed up as a surprise opponent for Deonna Purrazzo's Knockouts title. Purrazzo has plowed through the women's division, the Knockouts division, and is accepting outside challengers now, I guess. Gail Kim, I know, had promised her a surprise opponent at the pay-per-view. I thought that that was setting it up for it to be Gail herself for one last match. So I did not see that surprise coming with Thunder Rosa being the one to come out. And they had a good match. Purrazzo won. They put over the Knockouts champion. Mickie James made her Impact Wrestling return after the match to invite Deonna to the all-women's NWA pay-per-view that Mickie is producing next month. And Purrazzo told her to get lost, take your trash bag with you. I like that little burn there. And James kicked her head off. So it looks like the NWA has a main event now for its pay-per-view. These are very strange times indeed, with Impact working with the NWA again. But this is a very different NWA than it was during the days of NWA TNA. You know, this is a Billy Corgan operation now. It's not the NWA as it traditionally was. And a very different Impact for that matter. Right, the leadership and the executive hierarchy in the company, a lot has changed since those days. But they also announced their Bound for Glory show this year will be taking place in October in Las Vegas with representation from AEW, New Japan, and AAA, which is very cool. The problem is their show can still barely crack 100,000 viewers each week. That's about all they can muster. And that's even with all of the crossover that they've been doing. I mean, it's like every time they get some buzz going or they pop what for them would be considered a big number, whether it's a television rating or a pay-per-view buy rate, it just dies right back down. This company can never get any sort of sustained momentum going for itself. I think it's great that these companies are working together. It's one of the things that seemed to have really ratcheted up during the pandemic era. It's going to be one of the positives when we look back coming out of this whole pandemic period is hopefully an understanding amongst all these companies that, you know what, it's not such a terrible thing to work together. I mean, not that there weren't partnerships and alliances before, but it seems like now a lot of these companies are more open to working with each other more often. It just doesn't seem that Impact is getting the level of benefit out of it that they should in terms of increasing the viewership, which is still a problem for them. And Kenny Omega is still the Impact World Champion with a win over Sami Callihan. They had a hardcore style match with garbage and plunder, pizza cutters, barbed wire, thumbtacks. Omega continues his dominance. Impact should be grateful to have him coming in for these big matches and putting himself through this kind of abuse. Omega, the Good Brothers, and Callis, they're too sweeting each other in the ring after the match when all of a sudden the lights go out. And when they come back on, Jay White walks out with his never open weight title representing Bullet Club. He gets in the ring. They tease that he might put up the hand signal to join with them. And then all of a sudden, somebody runs out from the back, but we can't see who it is because they immediately cut away and they end the pay-per-view, which I have read was something that was not a mistake. It was done that way by design. It was done as a cliffhanger. And you know what? They need all the cliffhangers they can get to try to get people to tune into that TV show. So it's smart. I don't know that it's going to work, but it's smart. And apparently it was Juice Robinson and David Finlay who ran out. And Jay White dropped Juice with the Blade Runner and then he fled. He is scheduled to defend the Never Belt against Finlay next month at a New Japan show. So a nice tease of whether he is with Omega or not. It could be building to a match between the two at some point. If they can get their act together on the COVID front over there in Japan. Because it is still, it's really bad. I mean, it's really bad over there right now. Travel still is not easy. There's still a lot of restrictions. If they can ever get past that and get their shit together, Kenny Omega will wrestle again in a Tokyo Dome main event. There is not a doubt in my mind. And I'm not saying that like he'll be under contract again one day to New Japan. Omega is going to wrestle again for New Japan. He is going to wrestle for New Japan. He is going to be in the Tokyo Dome, possibly in the main event. It is only a matter of when do they do it. Have things improved enough by the time, let's say, Wrestle Kingdom rolls around at the beginning of next year? That would be the place to do it. Now, as far as Jay White goes, it was too bad. My thought coming out of the show, I mean, Impact fans won't want to hear this, but my thought was it's too bad they didn't save that for an episode of Dynamite in front of a bigger crowd. I mean, Jay White comes out, and I know Jay White isn't the biggest wrestling star in the world, but to this audience, even to an AEW audience, to an Impact audience, they know who Jay White is. They would pop for him. Jay White, you know, he walks out here, and it was like walking out at a VFW hall in front of 100 people. Him showing up on TNT, he would have gotten a superstar reaction. I mean, Kenta got a big reaction when they did the big reveal with him, and that was in Daly's place in front of, what, 1,000 people? So it's too bad they couldn't save this for, you know, a bigger show, make this a bigger deal. But you know what? Now really would not be the ideal time to tease something like that on AEW television if the focus is really supposed to be on Hangman Page challenging Kenny for the title. So timing-wise, I don't know that I would do that on Dynamite. So maybe I would have saved Jay White for a few months down the road. But anyway, that was my Slammiversary thoughts. You know, the action I saw was very good. Obviously, I'm not following all of the different stories that are going on right now with some of the undercard stuff in Impact. They have a lot of very talented people who work for the company. The pieces are there. It's just they can never really seem to put it together to generate enough momentum to just kind of boost them up back to that next level. But they should be very grateful and very happy that they have access to all of this outside talent, whether it's a Thunder Rosa or a Kenny Omega, Jay White showing up, because if you strip all of that away, you know, what you're left with is a promotion that has some great talents on the roster, but not a whole lot going on. Not a whole lot to really talk about. And the Moose thing, again, just, I was just laughing. I mean, I couldn't help but laugh at that. I mean, Moose being rolled up by Chris Sabin, I mean, it's just ridiculous. But anyway, that was Slammiversary last night. This was a great week for AEW. They put on what I thought was the best top-to-bottom episode of Dynamite that they have ever produced. Jon Moxley was back defending his IWGP United States title, which he will be defending against Lance Archer in a Texas death match this Wednesday. I had said Archer needs this win, and he does, but a lot of you astutely pointed out that Archer is no longer a contracted New Japan talent, so they can't just unilaterally give him the championship. True enough, but I still think he should win. And even if he's not under New Japan contract, that does not mean they can't work something out to facilitate a title change on TV. The relationship seems to be as good as it's ever been right now between AEW and New Japan. So I still think he has a shot at winning. Ricky Starks is the new FTW champion, and Brian Cage has been excommunicated from Team Taz. Hangman Page got a superstar reaction, just a megastar reaction, challenging Kenny Omega to an AEW world title match. Cody Rhodes and Malakai Black, they had a big pull-apart brawl. And Darby Allin, main event Darby, bringing in the numbers again, beat Ethan Page in a coffin match. Over 1 million live viewers for Dynamite this week. They were back above a million, their best number in more than 2 months. First for the night on all of cable. And, you know, you kind of get used to hearing that for WWE. Not every week, but on a lot of weeks. Raw, as bad as a lot of those shows have been, still will end up being number one on cable for the night. For AEW to be able to pull that off is a feather in their cap, because that's not something, they don't have months and years of being number one on, you know, cable on any night. The fact that they can do something like that is pretty impressive. And what's great about that is that it means that that entire month off, all the preemptions, a month of preemptions from the usual time slot, didn't have as negative an impact on them as you would have expected. They rebounded very quickly. And they better enjoy it while it lasts, because they have a lot of competition in the next couple of months with the Olympics. They have that show, The Challenge, is coming back to MTV next month, which did big numbers last season. But the other great news for AEW was how well the ticket on sale was for their New York City debut in September at Arthur Ashe Stadium. They moved so many seats, they decided to open up sections that they were not planning on opening. So they're not sold out yet, but they have a very good shot at it. They've already sold more than 15,000 tickets for the show. This will be the highest attended show in AEW history. And you couple that with their Newark show the week before, it means that on back-to-back weeks, AEW is going to be bringing in more than 30,000 fans to the New York, New Jersey area. And that, coupled with WWE selling over 40,000 seats so far for SummerSlam in Las Vegas next month, which is very likely going to surpass 50,000 once they announce the John Cena-Roman Reigns main event, if that's what it is. It's great to see. It's a great thing to see. It's great to see that despite the restrictions and 16 months of no fans, the level of enthusiasm is still there to come out and to see these shows. I want to see both promotions do well. I just want them to do it the right way, which is why I get so frustrated with the stuff I see on TV. But it wasn't all good news for WWE this week. A live SmackDown in Atlanta that was scheduled for September 17th was canceled, with no reason given. They had a pre-sale already, and about an hour before the general on-sale, the event got pulled. There was also a super show in Gainesville, Florida that was set for August 8th that was canceled with no reason given. And according to WrestleTix on Twitter, they had over 1,200 tickets sold so far for that super show with a capacity of about 3,400. Not a very big venue. So, you know, it's not as if they only moved about 500 seats. I don't know what's going on here, but if you can't sell out a small venue like that for a super show with Raw and SmackDown talent, that ain't good. Before this week, the last SmackDown in front of live fans was March 6th of last year in Buffalo, New York. 70 weeks later, they were in Houston on Friday for what I thought was a good show. You know, it's kind of funny to look back on, you know, that first SmackDown coming out of 9/11. It's kind of one of those memorable landmark SmackDowns you think back to. That also was in Houston. So the first post-9/11 SmackDown was in Houston, and the first post-pandemic era episode of SmackDown also in Houston. They have a new set that they're using for Raw and SmackDown, which really isn't all that different than the previous set. It's just a giant screen. Not very creative. Looked good. Not saying it didn't look good, but not really thinking outside the box, though, if you're trying to come up with an innovative new set that makes the show look and feel different. This doesn't get the job done. But the first person to greet the fans, much like WrestleMania, was Vince McMahon, who strutted out and said, "Where the hell have you been?" before strutting right back to the locker room area. Short and sweet. The man can't cut promos anymore. He can't with that voice. He can't do it. It's very sad. So the less he speaks, the better. But Edge got a monster reaction when he came out for the opening six-man tag. I'm going to get into some of the match results when I do my Money in the Bank preview here in a second. But a huge reaction for Edge when he came out. Finn Balor, back on the main roster. He interrupted a Sami Zayn promo. He delivered the double stomp off the top rope. I am really hoping we get NXT Balor and not smiling babyface Balor. But he's out of Triple H's hands now. He is back in the clutches of Vince McMahon, who likes his smiley baby faces. So I think we all know how this is going to go. Raw and SmackDown badly need new faces, though. So I don't hate the move. I just hate what I fear the changes might be to his character on TV. I don't hate the move itself. Balor did all he could do in NXT. And he could have hung around for another 6 months or another year. He could have been one of those guys like a Tommaso Ciampa or an Adam Cole, who's already been champion multiple times, and he's, you know, fought all the big NXT names there are, and he just sort of hangs around to improve the brand and, you know, face some of the newer guys. But, you know, Balor is somebody, it's not like he's at the end of his career. You know, he's got more to accomplish. And as we talk about how badly Raw and SmackDown need a refresh, and we have a draft coming up, although, according to Andrew Zarian, the dates of the draft have changed. It is no longer going to be the end of August, beginning of September. They are now looking at early October, which has been the usual time they reserve for these shakeups, which is a terrible time because then it goes right, a month later, it goes right into Survivor Series and the whole brand warfare thing, which means nothing because you just had a bunch of people who went from one brand to the other and they're supposed to pledge brand loyalty 6 weeks later. It's ridiculous. So there will be a draft, it's just not going to be coming for a little while longer. And the draft will hopefully help shake things up a little bit, but they badly need an infusion of new talent, both male and female, especially female. And I know they're taking steps to work towards that on SmackDown. They have Tegan Knox, they have Shotzi Blackheart, they have Toni Storm is on her way in. I mean, they're going to have to bring some new faces in now. You got Bayley gone for 9 months. But on the men's side, on both brands, they need some new faces too. So again, I don't hate the move. Speaking of Shotzi Blackheart, we had Shotzi and Tegan Knox picking up another win over the Women's Tag Team Champions, non-title, in fluky fashion. Beating the champions twice earns them a tag team title match in the future, and they should win. Because I don't care if they beat Natty and Tamina another 5 times. Hey, fuck, let them beat Natty and Tamina every week until the end of the year. If they're fluke wins, and then they lose when it counts, you have accomplished nothing. Nada. So they should win. Other than establishing that these women can't hang, which is all that you establish if they go to the big title match, and then they fall short. Bianca Belair, she retained her SmackDown Women's title over Carmella. They had a good match. Neither woman is on the show at the pay-per-view because Bianca lost her match with Bayley when Bayley went down with the ACL tear. You know, by the time Bayley comes back from this injury, if she really is out the full 9 months, it's going to be 2 years since this woman will have wrestled in front of actual people, actual fans. She didn't have a match at WrestleMania this year. So you can't count that. That's pretty nuts. And they ended with a fatal four-way involving the 4 SmackDown participants in the men's Money in the Bank match. I'll talk more about that in a second. One last thing on SmackDown. The crowd was hot for most of the show. There were some matches in between where they were just kind of like not really into it that much. But I don't want this to come off as me saying that the crowd was not hot, was not, you know, into what they were seeing, especially when the show went on the air. All right, these people were amped up. They were excited to see Roman Reigns. They were excited to see Edge and Rey Mysterio and all the stars. But as I predicted, they are still piping in crowd noise. I told you that they have their new play toy. This is not something they're going to willingly give up. It was very noticeable during some of the matches, especially the women's title match. You hear all that noise, and then you look out into the crowd, and they're just sitting there. I sometimes find myself, when I go back now and I watch these old episodes of Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, because I didn't really notice it as much when I was younger. But I go back now and I watch on Peacock. You know, they have episodes of Superstars up from 92 and 93, 94. And it's really noticeable, like when you look for it, when you're aware of it, that they will sweeten the crowd noise. But you look out into the crowd and these poor people have probably been sitting there at a marathon taping for about 3.5 hours at that point, watching nothing but fucking, you know, Repo Man squash matches and stuff like that. The Berserker coming out and beating people, you know, 2 different matches in the same taping. They're just sitting there, but the crowd sounds awfully animated. That's kind of what it was like watching parts of this show on Friday night. And, you know, one of my listeners, he tweeted me. He was at the show. And he watched it back on TV when he got home. So it's 2 o'clock in the morning and he sends me a tweet. And he tells me, dude, they were piping in crowd noise, especially during the backstage segments. Yes. Yes, they were. And it's too bad because the crowd was enthusiastic enough on its own. It didn't need that extra little boost because it just wasn't necessary. But this is not going to go away. You know, when you have over a year of being able to produce your show like it's some kind of movie, you're the director and you want everything to go exactly the way that you want it to go, you're able to manipulate these reactions to your liking. Yeah, you give somebody that power, they're not going to willingly give it up. So your ears do not deceive you if you felt the same way. To answer that question, because I got that from a few people, yes, they are still piping in crowd noise. And no, they are not going to stop. Money in the Bank is live Sunday night from Dickies Arena in Fort Worth, Texas. Last I checked, there were only about 100 tickets shy of a sellout, which would be around 10,000 people. I've got predictions, and I've got some big news on who may be challenging for the WWE Championship at SummerSlam. You might consider it a spoiler. So you have been warned. But first, though, I've got two important contests real quick here to tell you about. First is the Wrestle Rumble Money in the Bank Pick'em Contest. Top prize of $1,000 cash. The deadline to enter is 8 p.m. Eastern Sunday night, right when the pay-per-view begins. The winners will be announced on Monday. Some of the questions include how many tables will break during the men's Money in the Bank match. Will there be a cash-in for the men or the women? Who will leave Money in the Bank as WWE champion and as the Universal champion? You guys can answer these questions. Go ahead, purchase your entry right now, WrestleRumble.com. And Sunday night is the night. I am very excited about this. I get to pick one lucky winner at random to win the one-of-a-kind custom Solomonster championship belt. Solomonster Sounds Off belt. It's only $1 to enter. You may do so as many times as you wish, up until the 8 p.m. cutoff on Sunday night when Money in the Bank goes live. And then as soon as the pay-per-view goes off the air, join me live on YouTube for my full recap, where I will also be picking the winner at random on the air. Will it be you? It could be. But only if you enter. You got to be in it to win it. 9 pounds of silver could be yours. So get in on that. They have added a kickoff match to the show, and it is a big one. Rey and Dominic Mysterio will defend their SmackDown Tag Team titles against the Usos. It has now been almost 2 full weeks. We are closing in on 2 full weeks. And WWE still has yet to publicly address Jimmy Uso being arrested for the 4th time? 5th time? In the last decade, whichever it is. I've lost track. What message does that send if they win the titles here in this match? The match itself should be great. I mean, the Usos and the Shield had a tag team title match on the Money in the Bank kickoff the year that I went to the show in Philly in 2013 that was tremendous. They had another with the New Day on the SummerSlam pre-show 4 years ago. Jimmy and Jay are the kickoff kings. But bad behavior should not be rewarded. The Mysterios should win and then defend the titles at SummerSlam against Otis and Chad Gable. And I think they will, with the Usos pinning Rey on SmackDown Friday night in that 6-man tag. I think Rey and Dom get the win, and if that doesn't fit the story they're telling with Roman Reigns, you know what? Too bad. It's not needed. We have the Raw Tag Team titles being defended by AJ Styles and Omos against the Viking Raiders. This was originally announced for Raw this coming Monday, but plans change. With the SmackDown Women's title match being bumped off the pay-per-view, they decided to slide this match in there. The Viking Raiders won a battle royal last month to earn the right to challenge for the titles. Ivar got a singles win over AJ Styles last Monday, while Omos got a win over Eric. It was the first singles match for Omos on TV, and he didn't do much, which is probably for the better. He is so big, you just sort of have to work around him, which is what Eric did. I have Styles and Omos to retain because you have to have them defend against Randy Orton and Matt Riddle at SummerSlam. You cannot first hit the road and then break them up, which is what I hear some people suggesting, that Orton is going to show up during the Men's Money in the Bank match and cost Riddle the briefcase. It's too soon for that. We haven't even seen these two wrestle as a team in front of live fans. You're going to break them up? That would be insanely stupid. That is the match you save for SummerSlam, and you do the title change there. Rhea Ripley and her Raw Women's Championship will be on the line against Charlotte Flair. The creative has not been compelling at all for this feud, but we know these two can have a great match because I saw one with my own eyes at WrestleMania last year. In an empty warehouse, they had an excellent match. Rhea Ripley picked up a win over Natalya last Monday, and after the match, Charlotte appeared and she chop-blocked Rhea, as Rhea did to her before. And then she put her in a figure-four leg lock with Charlotte hanging over the apron outside the ring to apply maximum pressure while Rhea screamed in pain. I think they did that to give Rhea an out when she loses the title. I mean, look, it's possible they did it to make her seem like an even bigger babyface when she overcomes the injury and she wins. But I don't think so. I think they did that to give her an out when she loses. I think she comes into the match at less than 100%. She fights valiantly through the pain, but in the end, Charlotte wins her 11th women's championship singles title on the main roster. This will not be the end of this feud. Either way, this will not be the end of this feud, but I think Charlotte gets the title. We have the women's Money in the Bank ladder match with Asuka, who won last year's match on the roof at Titan Tower, Nikki Ash, Alexa Bliss, Naomi, Zelina Vega, Liv Morgan, Natalya, and Tamina. A waste of a final spot. They were dangling the carrot of there being one open spot left in this match, and they give it to Tamina. I liked my Sonya Deville idea much better. In fact, I like it so much that I am sticking with my prediction, and I am picking someone who is not even officially in the match to win Money in the Bank. I am predicting that Sonya Deville is going to win. Liv Morgan is going to be attacked at the pay-per-view before the match by a mystery assailant and taken out of Money in the Bank. And in her place, Sonya Deville will enter herself into Money in the Bank and she will win. And we'll come to find out eventually that it wasn't Carmella who took out Liv, even though they'll tease that's who it was. It was Sonya. Liv was right. Sonya had it out for her the entire time. So that's my prediction. Bobby Lashley defends the WWE Championship against Kofi Kingston. They did something on Monday night that I hate. I know, shocking. They pinned the champion on TV. Not just any champion, but one of their top champions. Lashley got rolled up and pinned by Xavier Woods. But I'm going to give them a pass on this one time, because it played into the story they were trying to tell. For weeks, Kofi Kingston has talked about how Lashley's been losing his focus with all the partying and all of the women. He's taken his eye off the ball. He's back at the hotel. He's shooting up an eight ball. This guy's out of control. And on Raw last Monday, he was proven right. And Lashley was humiliated. And what it led to was the best promo of Bobby Lashley's entire career in WWE. I put the WWE qualifier in there because Lashley did some really good stuff in Impact when he was the champion. I don't recall every single promo he ever did in Impact, though, so I can't say it was better or worse than those. But this is the best promo I've ever seen Lashley cut. He had left the building after the loss, only to return later in the night for the final edition of the VIP lounge from the Thunderdome. MVP was doing one last VIP lounge. He had the champagne on ice. He had the ladies with him. I guess the ladies are not coming on the road with them. Lashley looked all disheveled. He came down. He asked the ladies to leave. And then he said, you know, he was thinking about what Kofi said. And Kofi was right. MVP has made him soft. He said he appreciated everything MVP has done for him. But this is bullshit, he said. This bullshit needs to stop now. Boy, is that a soundbite that I can clip and get a lot of use out of. Back to business. That's what he said. Back to business. Before he started throwing all the furniture out of the ring. This was a great segment. I did not see this as a split between Lashley and MVP. More of a kind of a wake-up call, a warning to MVP that it's time to get serious and get back to basics. The angle at the end of the show justified what they did at the beginning of the show. So many times they do these dumb finishes, they pin champions. It doesn't lead anywhere. It doesn't lead to a title match or... And I don't know that Xavier Woods is getting a title match either. But at least this led somewhere that made sense. And I thought it was well done. Kofi Kingston is not winning the WWE Championship. The end result of this should be the destruction of the New Day by Bobby Lashley. He is my pick to win. We have the men's Money in the Bank ladder match with one hell of a lineup that they have assembled here. Drew McIntyre, Matt Riddle, Ricochet, John Morrison representing Raw. Kevin Owens, Big E, Shinsuke Nakamura, and Seth Rollins representing SmackDown. One of the things I like is that there are enough plausible choices that the outcome is not too obvious. Lots of different ways they can go with this. Nakamura has no chance. He's got his crown. He's got Rick Boogs. He doesn't need it. Kevin Owens winning and then torturing Paul Heyman for months, you know, teasing that he might cash in. I mean, that could be entertaining. But we've already seen Reigns and Owens. I don't see Owens flipping sides and going over to Raw to go after the WWE title, so he seems unlikely. Ricochet and Morrison, they've had some really good TV matches in recent weeks. I thought their Falls Count Anywhere match last Monday was the best thing on the show. It was Ricochet doing Ricochet things, which he should be doing more of. But he is not winning the briefcase, and neither is Johnny Drip Drip. He's not winning the fucking briefcase. Which leaves us with McIntyre, Riddle, Rollins, and Big E. Vince McMahon clearly loves Matt Riddle and finds him amusing, or we wouldn't have Riddle all over the television show the way we do every week. If Riddle were to win, it introduces a new wrinkle to his relationship with Randy Orton. More comedy. You know, we got our fill of comedy last year with Otis. McIntyre, he is no longer allowed to challenge for the WWE title so long as Lashley is the champion. Him winning Money in the Bank could be a way around that, but they also run the risk of turning the crowd against him by constantly feeding him title matches. His reaction on Sunday is going to be very telling because you know a lot of people are going to be pulling for Big E, or they're going to be pulling for Riddle over Drew. Past few weeks, they started a program with McIntyre and Jinder Mahal. Mahal stole his prize sword, which is what happens when you bring your fucking sword to work. On Monday, Drew revealed that it was a replica that Jinder and his men stole. It was not the real thing. And then he destroyed Jinder's motorcycle, the same motorcycle we saw him use exactly once on television, but apparently he had this great attachment to it. But Drew destroyed his property and he embarrassed him. He embarrassed Jinder Mahal on Monday night. And so it stands to reason that Jinder is going to want to extract a measure of revenge. And what better way to do that than to cost Drew McIntyre his shot at winning the briefcase? The one avenue that he has left available to him, possibly, to get back the WWE Championship, and Jinder Mahal takes it away from him. I think Mahal and his minions get involved. Maybe they push Drew off a ladder or something, which takes him out of the running. But I don't think Drew McIntyre is winning Money in the Bank. which narrows the field down to two. Before SmackDown on Friday night, my pick to win this match was Seth Rollins. And I was going to do my Money in the Bank predictions a few days earlier, and I'm glad I waited. Now, Rollins, you know, he was furious when Adam Pearce and Sonya Deville granted Edge a title match against Roman Reigns. He flipped out on talking smack that one week that it was promised to me. Edge doesn't deserve it. I'm not the one who took 6 months off. I was here every week. This is all to build to a match between the two at SummerSlam. So I had Rollins winning the briefcase and then cashing in later that same night. He does to Roman Reigns, or tries to do to Roman Reigns, the same thing he did to him at WrestleMania 31. He cashes in during the match to make it a triple threat. And he delivers a curb stomp to Edge. Then we get a spear from Roman Reigns. That takes out Rollins, and Roman Reigns retains the championship. But then I watched the end of SmackDown on Friday with Rollins winning a fatal four-way over Big E, Owens, and Nakamura, and posing with the briefcase on top of the ladder. He's cackling like a hyena, and it became very obvious that Seth Rollins is not going to win Money in the Bank. I believe the man who is winning that contract is the man who Rollins curb-stomped onto a ladder and pinned in that match, and that man is Big E. Big E winning the briefcase is intriguing if Lashley massacres the New Day in the WWE title match. They have made it clear the winner can cash in on any champion of their choosing this year, which means Big E, even though he's a SmackDown guy, could decide to cash in on the Raw champion if he wants. And who better to get revenge for Kofi and Woods than Big E at SummerSlam if Brock Lesnar isn't coming back, and it looks likely that Lesnar is not coming back at SummerSlam. Ponytail Brock, I'm sure you saw the photos this week. Ponytail Brock has become a butcher, and he is living his best life right now. He is not thinking of SummerSlam. He is not thinking of 120-degree heat in Vegas in August. He seems perfectly content doing whatever it is that he's doing. The story with Big E would work. The fans, I think, they like the guy. They want to see him succeed. They want to see him move up the ladder. He could and he may literally move up the ladder and grab the briefcase. He could win the briefcase and show up on Raw the following night to announce his intentions of cashing in at SummerSlam. He can call his shot like Babe Ruth, or like Rob Van Dam did all those years ago before he cashed in on John Cena. I like that story. Especially a more serious, focused Big E who is on a mission for revenge because of what has happened to his friends. Now, there's also another possibility with a Big E win, which is that Kofi Kingston does win the WWE Championship, which he won't. But let's say he does, and then Big E cashes in on Kofi and goes heel. And the reason I bring this up is Big E spoke with Alex McCarthy of TalkSport, and he revealed the idea of a New Day split was pitched by none other than Vince McMahon himself after the Kofi Mania stuff in 2019. And all three men rejected it. They vetoed the idea, they got it nixed. But the fact that Vince even had the idea in his mind tells you that there is a chance that it could happen. But I don't see it. Why? Just ask the question, why? That's what I would do if I was sitting in these creative meetings. I mean, boy, they would hate my guts. I wouldn't last a week in that company. Because my favorite question would be, why? Always ask why. Why are we doing this? What is Big E's motivation? What is his rationale for turning against his best friends? Jealousy? He had success on SmackDown as the Intercontinental Champion. It's not like he hasn't been doing anything. It would just be having him turn for the sake of turning. Now, Kofi turning on Woods, that would have made sense with the MVP storyline when MVP was trying to stir things up and he was trying to tell Kofi that Woods was holding him back. That's why you never got your rematch for the WWE title. You were stuck in a tag team. That story could have worked. But they didn't. They ended up not going that way. But Big E turning doesn't work. The other scenario does. The other scenario works much better. But apparently it doesn't for WWE. I'll get to why here in a second. That ties in with that little spoiler I mentioned earlier. We've got Roman Reigns defending the championship of the universe against Edge. The man who never did get the one-on-one match he was promised by winning the Royal Rumble. Daniel Bryan ruined that for him at WrestleMania. All you need to know is that it is going to be Roman Reigns defending against John Cena at SummerSlam. That is the money match. The bigger money match is Reigns against The Rock, but that's for WrestleMania next year. Seth Rollins, I predict, will still cost Edge the victory, even though it won't be via cash-in, when he loses the Money in the Bank match earlier in the night. He's going to just be so beside himself, he will not allow Edge to have his moment, and he will take it away from him, and Roman Reigns will retain his championship. It's very simple. Roman Reigns is not losing the title. Bobby Lashley has a better chance of losing his title of Money in the Bank than Roman Reigns does, and I don't think he has much of a chance of losing his title. So Roman has even less of a chance. But that's your Money in the Bank card. I hope to see all of you live in the chat on YouTube after the pay-per-view. But that brings me to the big news of the last few days, which is a report from Fightful, one of the more reliable sites out there, that Bill Goldberg is on his way back to WWE television. That was the plan as of Thursday afternoon, and he will be on Monday Night Raw this week. And guess who Goldberg is going to be challenging at SummerSlam? Bobby Lashley. And if I'm right, and Lashley retains his WWE Championship at Money in the Bank, then it would be for the WWE title. Which would render my Big E prediction pretty fucking useless, I guess, now wouldn't it? You know, it would be nice to see Vince McMahon go all in on someone and try to create a new star here. But he's back to his tried and true, which is, we have a stadium to fill, so what legend can we dust off and use? I know what they're doing here. They're going back on the road in front of live audiences. They want all hands on deck to get people watching. That's why we hear about John Cena coming back. And Becky Lynch. And now Goldberg. And there may be others. Goldberg is under contract for at least 2 matches per year based on his current deal. This is what he himself has said. That deal runs through at least next year. I can't remember if it's 2023 that it expires or 2022. I think it's 2022. And he could always extend that. And, you know, Goldberg, look, the fact that we're going to be getting more Goldberg is not a shock. It was inevitable. We knew this already. And Goldberg, in a short, explosive squash, depending on who he's squashing, or you could say even putting over somebody new, depending on who it is fairly unoffensive. My issue, my big issue here, is that we just saw Billy Boy brought in to wrestle Drew McIntyre at the Royal Rumble for that same WWE Championship. And he lost to McIntyre, as he should have. So why do we need to see him challenging for the championship again? What is gained from this? Goes back to what I said a few minutes ago. Ask the question, why? Why? He lost to Braun Strowman. He would have lost to Roman Reigns, but he lost to Braun instead when Roman went home. He lost to Drew McIntyre. Even if Lashley beats him, what is gained from any of this? Brock Lesnar lost to Drew McIntyre that same weekend, by the way, where Goldberg lost to Strowman. But Lesnar against Lashley is a match that a lot of people have wanted to see for many years. Let's say Goldberg comes in and loses. I just don't see what's accomplished or how that benefits Lashley in any meaningful way. Not after Goldberg lost clean to Drew the way he did. The same Drew McIntyre that Lashley went on to beat. Multiple times. Drew beat Goldberg, Lashley beat Drew, and now we're supposed to get excited for Lashley against Goldberg. This is a classic case. This feels like we couldn't get Brock. We couldn't reach a deal with Brock. He was at the butcher. We couldn't get Brock. So Goldberg is the consolation prize. And if the idea, and if I'm totally off here, and the idea is that Goldberg is actually going to be the one to beat Lashley and win the title, then you can just fuck right the hell off, is what you can do. You have a story with the destruction of the New Day at the hands of Bobby Lashley and a more serious Big E marching in to avenge his friends and try to take down the Almighty, right? There's the story. That would be a fine alternative to a match. If you can't get Brock Lesnar, big marquee match, I think that would be a perfectly fine alternative. Big E is not the star that Brock is. He's not the star that Goldberg is. But why does Goldberg need to be challenging for the championship when he already had his shot this same calendar year? And that didn't make much sense either. I still maintain the match to do at the Royal Rumble with Goldberg would have been against Randy Orton, because Orton was the one disrespecting the legends at that time, not Drew. I mean, hell, you could still do Goldberg against Orton at SummerSlam, the spear against the RKO. I mean, Orton, I'd still rather see him and Riddle win the belts, because I think that's kind of where everything is building to. But I'm just saying, you could still do, we've not seen that match since what, 2003? I don't even know if they had a match in 2003. Did Goldberg wrestle Orton in his first run with WWE? He might have, but that was so long ago, I don't even count that. It's almost 20 years ago. Orton against Goldberg, Orton would be a fresh opponent for Goldberg if they wanted to go down that road. You do the spear against the RKO, I think that would be fine. And everybody's saying, oh, maybe Riddle wins Money in the Bank. I mean, consider this. Maybe Riddle wins Money in the Bank and then Goldberg wins the title at SummerSlam and Riddle cashes in. You have all been out in the sun for too long. Goldberg is not working with Matt Riddle. And Goldberg should not ever be beating Bobby Lashley. Keep him the fuck away from the title. Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff passed away this week at the age of 71. His son Travis announced the news on his Instagram. He had been taking care of his father, who was dealing with late-stage dementia. There was a really sad video he posted a few weeks ago of Orndorff. He was either in the hospital or hospice, and he didn't look good at all. He didn't look like he even recognized who his own son was. My earliest memories of Mr. Wonderful date back to the first WrestleMania and WWE's national expansion. You know, when I was first getting into wrestling, it was all about the whole rock and wrestling era. So Hogan, Piper, Andre, all of those guys. Orndorff was part of that crew. I had my Orndorff LJN figure. By the way, AEW is working with LJN now. I don't know how many of you saw that this week. They're bringing back the LJN figures. I don't know how similar they're going to look to the old ones, but they are bringing them back. So I thought that was pretty cool. But anyway, it was Hogan and Mr. T with Jimmy Snuka in their corner at the first WrestleMania against Piper and Orndorff with Cowboy Bob Orton in theirs. This was the very first WrestleMania main event. And there was an errant shot by Orton with his arm cast that led to Orndorff taking the losing fall for their team. That led to a babyface turn and a tag team with Hulk Hogan. Very much the blueprint for the Mega Power story that Hogan did later on with Randy Savage. And Orndorff and Savage are probably the two people Hogan made the most money working with throughout his entire career in terms of working like a full-blown program. You know, once each of those guys turned heel on him, Hogan was such a big babyface back then. You know, we're talking 86, 89. He was still very popular. Made a lot of money. But I just covered the Great Betrayal, I think it was last week in the history segment, in 1986. It was a tag team match against King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd. Orndorff was upset. They did this little vignette in the back, not vignette, but like a little backstage segment where, and I still laugh because when I go back and I watch it, the camera cuts to Hogan and Orndorff in the back, and Hogan, he's looking at somebody off camera. Maybe it was Vince McMahon waiting for a cue. So like there was like a pause before he started talking. It was comical. But the story was that Orndorff was upset that he was trying to call Hogan during the week and Hogan wouldn't answer his call. And Hogan said, brother, I was under the squat rack in the gym. I was working out when you called me. He's like, forget about the call. Get your head right. We got a match out there. We got to go up against Bundy and Stud. So they were already teasing dissension between these two. Hogan blew right past him when they were making their entrance, like a fucking prima donna. Just walks right by the guy. Orndorff is in the ring first. He tells Hogan, look, I'm going to start the match off. You go stand out on the apron. I got this. And Orndorff went on a tear, and he had the crowd on its feet. He was doing the little Hogan, you know, the cupping of the ear and everything. Then he tagged in Hogan, and Hogan did the same. And he got the people even louder. And you can see Orndorff, he's angrily banging on the ropes in frustration like Hogan had just shown him up. And then Hogan accidentally collides with Orndorff. He knocks him off the apron. Now Hogan's being double teamed, 2-on-1. Orndorff was back up on the apron, and he's just watching. He wasn't even getting in the ring to help. Eventually he did, and then he lowered the boom. Clothesline Hogan, gave him a pile driver. The prettiest pile driver in all of wrestling is the one that Paul Orndorff would deliver. It looked great. And that led to the biggest live event feud in the history of the business. Those two made so much money together. Orndorff was supposedly pulling 20 grand a week at the peak of their feud. Hogan, I'm sure, if Orndorff was making 20 grand a week, I'm sure Hogan was making even more than that. They sold out almost everywhere they headlined, because you hear wrestlers say that all the time. They were hanging from the rafters. We sold out everywhere we went. And 98% of the time, they're full of shit. They might have sold well, but they didn't sell out. These two guys sold out almost everywhere they headlined, legit. But the big match came at the big event. In August of 86, CNE Stadium in Toronto, Canada, they were expecting about 25,000 fans. They ended up doing over 60,000. And the first $1 million gate for what was a local market show. This didn't air on pay-per-view. It wasn't televised. They did over 60,000 people for a VHS they put out later on Coliseum Video. All on the back of Hogan and Orndorff. That match drawing as well as it did is what led to Vince McMahon booking the Pontiac Silverdome for WrestleMania 3. Funny enough, the rumor was always that if, and I don't know that this has ever been verified, but the rumor has always been that if Andre was not physically able to go in time for WrestleMania in 87 against Hogan, that Orndorff was the backup who would have been used in that spot. I mean, they did have one famous TV match, which is another one of my earliest childhood wrestling memories from Saturday night's main event. Inside a steel cage, both men climbing down the cage on opposite sides at the same time. Their feet hit at the same time. They did a disputed finish that led to the match being restarted and Hogan winning. And that was the end of their feud. But I got an email this week from Alex from Toronto, the site of the big event. And he was asking about the Hogan-Orndorff feud in 86. And as successful as it was, how to him it seems like it doesn't get remembered as a classic. And, you know, wanting to know if that's because it lacked a WrestleMania main event, or was there heat with Orndorff and WWE, and that's why they don't really acknowledge him too much over the years. I'm not aware of there being any heat between the two sides. I think not being a WrestleMania main event like Hogan Andre was, or Hogan Savage, or Hogan Warrior, that is part of it. And I also think that it gets overshadowed by what came immediately after it, which was the build to the biggest match in history, the biggest match in company history, Hulk Hogan against Andre the Giant. They probably could have kept the feud going to WrestleMania 3, and they could have blew it off there, Hogan against Orndorff one-on-one, and did big business. I don't know if they would have had 70, 80, 90,000 fans. But then again, they put 60,000 in Toronto. So yeah, they probably could have. But Andre betraying Hogan and demanding a championship match was a much bigger match. I mean, as a wrestling match, you could say Hogan-Orndorff would have been better. Hogan-Andre, you know, it was what it was. Andre could barely move. Hogan had to sort of work around him. but you can't really vote against Hogan Andre. You can't not do that match. You're kind of shit out of luck if you're up against that. But Orndorff was injured during that big program with Hogan. They were working every night. He took a clothesline from Hogan one night. He landed the wrong way, hurt his shoulder. He had a herniated disc in his neck. He needed surgery, and he refused because of how much money he was making. Again, 20 grand a week. You're on top of the world. You're working with the biggest star in the business, selling out every building that you go to. He wasn't going to take time off the road to go get surgery and then be out for what, 6 months? This was the biggest run of his life. But what ended up happening is he suffered permanent nerve damage that led to a lot of weakness and atrophy of the muscles on the right side of his body, especially his arm. You can see after that how much smaller his right arm is than his left. But he ended up in WCW in the early 90s. After a short retirement, he became television champion. He had two runs with Paul Roma as tag team champions. They called themselves Pretty Wonderful, was the name of their team. And when he retired again, he transitioned to the power plant as a trainer. He had a hand in training a bunch of people, including Bill Goldberg. And he came back to wrestle at the Fall Brawl pay-per-view that WCW did in 2000. So by this time, this is like the dying days of WCW, the fall of 2000. And he was a surprise partner for the Filthy Animals and Big Vito against the Natural Born Thrillers. He still had that tan physique. He looked pretty good in there until giving a pile driver to Mark Jindrak. It looked like the back of his head may have smacked the mat. His body went limp. He was paralyzed for a bit. He suffered a stinger, kind of like what happened to Steve Austin at SummerSlam in the match with Owen Hart when he got dumped on his head. He lost all feeling in his body, Austin did, for about 45 seconds before he was finally able to move around. I'm sure it's one of the scariest feelings in the world. And they quickly pinned Orndorff to get him out of the match. The problem is, he was still laying there, and they continued to wrestle around him. I guess maybe it was an elimination match. They continued to wrestle around his body as he laid there on the mat. Until finally Charles Robinson had enough sense, or maybe he got a cue from someone, to call an end to the match so that the EMTs could come in and help Orndorff out of the ring. So it was kind of a sad way for his career to end. I think he ended up having another match many, many, many years later. But that was really the, you know, at least nationally televised. That was the end of his career. That was the last that people saw of Paul Orndorff. And the only silver lining, I guess, is that there weren't that many people watching WCW by that point anyway. How many people do you think even bought that pay-per-view? So hopefully not too many people saw that. But Orndorff had a reputation as being a tough dude. He was a street fighter before he even got into wrestling. You know, E. Honda and Zangief don't have shit on Mr. Wonderful. There was an infamous fight backstage at a WCW TV taping in 1995 that led to Vader leaving WCW and going to WWE. Orndorff was an agent at the time. Vader, and there's varying stories about exactly what happened and what led to it. The belief is that Vader had shown up late and he was supposed to be filming something or doing something. Words were exchanged. The truth probably lies in the middle somewhere, but Vader slapped him. They fought. Vader had claimed that he front face locked him and took him down to the ground. Bullet Bob Armstrong was there. He saw the whole thing and he said Paul just beat him until Vader started bleeding. Dave Penzer, the ring announcer, he told ProWrestlingStories.com that it had nothing to do with Vader being late or anything like that. He said Orndorff's description of the fight is pretty much the most accurate version. I know Orndorff started kicking Vader in the face with his flip-flops. That's all anybody talks about. The flip-flops. He had flip-flops on. He kicked the shit out of this guy with his flip-flops. But that was the end, not long after that, of Vader in WCW. Orndorff was diagnosed in 2011 with stage 4 lymph node cancer. In two different places he had it. All of the treatment that he needed for the cancer, as anybody who lives in this country knows, medical bills can bankrupt you in a hurry. And he had burned through his savings. He almost lost his house. He had over $9,000 in back taxes that he owed. I think that was all property taxes. A GoFundMe campaign was started to help him pay the property taxes so he wouldn't lose his home and help him pay for medication that he needed. I mean, how sad is that? It makes me so angry when I read that. That GoFundMes are even needed for that sort of thing so he can pay for the medication to keep himself alive. But the cancer and the treatment had an effect on his memory, as did all of the concussions over the course of his life. From football and from wrestling, because he was drafted by the New Orleans Saints, and he went to camp with the Chicago Bears. So he never actually played in an NFL game, but he was a pretty good football player by all accounts. I guess decided that he didn't want to do it, at least the first time. He left of his own volition, so it wasn't like he went to camp and he got cut. Who knows how far he would have gone had he pursued a career in the NFL. There are a lot of wrestlers who came from the NFL. Vader, Brian Pillman, Jim Neidhart, don't forget Mongo. Who knows? But he did suffer a lot of concussions over the course of his life, and I'm sure that played a role in the issues that he was plagued by later in life. I think the last appearance he made on WWE television would have been the birthday celebration they did in 2014 for Hulk Hogan. This was right before Brock Lesnar's destruction of John Cena at SummerSlam. It was sad because Orndorff got no reaction. I mean, he looked different. He had this handlebar mustache. He came out to his WCW music. How many people would have even known that that was his WCW music? But nobody recognized him. I do think he gets overlooked in a lot of conversations because that run with Hogan was largely kept off television and the injuries forced him into an early retirement. He was most definitely a draw. He did well everywhere he went, even before he got to WWE. All the different territories and promotions he worked for, he was a draw, he made money. And it's just very sad to see him go out like that with the memory issues. But make no mistake, Orndorff was a very big part of Vince McMahon's expansion in the mid-80s and why it was so successful. You know why Mr. Wonderful was so successful? He was hungry. He had a hunger in his belly. That's why he was so successful. I share that in common with Mr. Wonderful. I too am hungry. I too have a hunger in my belly. The only difference is instead of going out there and beating people up for a living, I go and I make myself a meal with HelloFresh when I get hungry. That's how I satisfy my hunger. That's what works for me. I don't have the physical gifts that Mr. Wonderful has. I don't look the way that he used to look. I go with the next best thing. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and recipes delivered right to your door. It's easy, it's fun, and it's affordable. That's why it is America's number one meal kit. The recipes are always easy to follow, quick to make. They cut out the need for grocery store trips so you can get dinner on the table, usually in 30 minutes or less. Or breakfast, or lunch, for that matter. That's why it's the number one meal kit. It's not a dinner kit. They've got meals that you can make on the go to fit in with your busy lifestyle. With HelloFresh, there's something for everyone, including low-calorie, vegetarian, and family-friendly recipes. They deliver fresh, high-quality, pre-portioned ingredients so that you can make meals that are delicious and nutritious. Over 90% of their ingredients are sourced directly from farmers to ensure that only the freshest produce and proteins are delivered right to your door. Dinner for me just the other night. I tweeted out some photos. I'm sure some of you saw that. I did their apricot ponzu chicken with ginger rice and roasted green beans. I'm getting hungry again just talking about it. Everything I needed was right there. I had the clove of garlic. I had the green beans. I had the chicken cutlets. I had the apricot jam. I didn't have to go searching for it and shopping in three or four different places. It was all right there for me. All I had to do was put it all together. All I had to do was follow the directions, and it turned out great. And if your biggest culinary masterpiece is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, if that's your claim to fame, I'm telling you, you can make this. It is so easy. I cannot recommend this kit enough. So it's time that you treated yourself. Go to HelloFresh.com/Solomonster14 and use the code Solomonster14 for up to 14 free meals plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/Solomonster14 and use the code Solomonster14 for up to 14 free meals, including free shipping. For HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. NXT was a strong episode this week with what might have been the swan song for Karrion Kross as the NXT champion. They may have figured out a way to get that title off of him while keeping him undefeated in NXT. Dakota Kai and Ember Moon had a really good opener. Poor Ember. First, she lost her tag team partner with Shotzi Don't Call Me Blackheart going to SmackDown. And now she lost her match clean to Dakota Kai. But the real story was after the match when Xia Li walked to the ring. She blew right past Kai. She walked up to Raquel Gonzalez to challenge her to a match for her NXT Women's Championship, which was accepted and will take place this Tuesday. Dakota had a look on her face like she was not happy about being ignored like that. She was disrespected. It was almost like she wasn't even there. But Xia Li is not winning the title because it is becoming clear that Dakota Kai is going to be the one to turn on Raquel Gonzalez and challenge her for the title, even though I think people would rather root for Dakota in her quest to become the champion. It feels like a turn is coming soon. I hope they go another way with it and just have her challenge Gonzalez one day. Cut a promo on her and just have her challenge her. She's sick and tired of being overlooked, being made the third wheel. I think the underdog story just works so much better. We have three vignettes throughout the show from LA Knight's home with Cameron Grimes as his butler. Every time Knight tried to make him do something that he thought would embarrass Grimes or make him upset, Grimes no-sold it, which only made Knight angry. He brought a barber in to cut Grimes' hair and trim his beard, but then Grimes loved the look when he was done. He goes, "Oh, I look great." Then Knight wanted him to cut all the grass in this big multi-acre backyard that he's got using only a tiny lawnmower. And Grimes said, "No problem. He has to do this sort of thing on the farm." And then later, Knight found a child in his backyard doing the work while Grimes was lounging out by the pool. He had paid the kid off to do the work for him because, remember, Grimes made a lot of money. Child labor. Knight told the kid to get lost, so the kid kicked him in the shin, and then Grimes accidentally knocked Knight into the pool. I thought these were fun, and Grimes is going to drive this guy absolutely nuts until he grants him another match for the $1 million belt, and that is where Cameron Grimes gets the big win. At the TakeOver show, SummerSlam weekend. That's how you do it. I'm still not feeling this Diamond Mine group yet, but they gave Tyler Rust a win over an established guy in Bobby Fish. Clean win. Kushida ran out after the match to make the save. That sets up a tag team match for this week. Fish and Kushida take on Strong and Rust. Saray, newest addition to the NXT Women's Division, all the way over from the land of the rising sun. Saray did not get her match that she had asked for with Toni Storm because Toni Storm is being moved to SmackDown. So Gigi Dolin took Storm's place, the former Priscilla Kelly. The two of them had a stiff match. I audibly yelled, which doesn't happen very often when I watch these shows, but I audibly yelled when Saray hit that running basement dropkick to Dolin. That looked brutal. She connected with all of that. And she followed it up with a high-angle Saito suplex for the win. Hopefully Dolin is okay. I haven't, read anything to suggest otherwise. And if she is, then good, because those last couple of moves looked great. I don't want to see anybody get hurt like Mercedes Martinez did on that kick from Xia Li, but if she can safely pull off moves that look like that, that look like she's murdering her opponent without actually murdering her opponent, she'll have the most believable offense of anybody on the NXT roster with moves like that, and she's probably the smallest person there. That's what makes it so funny. She's got to be the smallest person they have, or one of the smallest people on that roster. But she keeps pulling off moves like that, that get a reaction out of me like that, she'll have the best-looking offense of anybody in that entire brand. I like how she comes out to this pop music, all smiley and bubbly, and then she just fucking wrecks people. That could be her gimmick. That could be Saray's gimmick. See, that works. That's the Saray I want to see. Now, during their match, something else happened. Mandy Rose walked out onto the stage to observe, and then she left after Saray won. She probably should have looked at Saray and said, fuck, I'm going back to Raw. I don't want none of this. I'm going back to wrestling Natty and Tamina. I don't want to wrestle this woman. But she was out there, and then she just walked to the back, and I thought, boy, that's random. But per PW Insider, Mandy Rose has officially been moved from the Raw roster to the NXT roster full-time. WrestleVotes claims that it was part of a trade, sending Mandy to NXT in exchange for Aaliyah being moved down to Raw. Aaliyah has been in developmental and on NXT for 6 years. She has been a mainstay down there. And she doesn't even get that much television time. As long as she's been down there for, she should be like the fucking Tommaso Ciampa of the women's division, where she's like the grizzled veteran who's down there just wrestling all the newcomers. And that she's no Ciampa. But it's not even like, you know, in the whole gimmick that she was in, part of the Robert Stone brand, Aaliyah is a featured performer in that division. She's just been, I guess, training and just toiling down there for the last 6 years. She's never really been involved in any kind of meaningful program. I mean, to be honest with you, I was surprised she wasn't let go during their last couple of rounds of cuts. I was surprised she survived all the cuts. It just didn't seem like they had any real plans for her, so why would they keep her around? How many times have we heard people get cut? What were they told, besides budget cuts? What were they told? Oh, creative doesn't have anything for you. Well, that would seem to apply to Aaliyah. And yet, she survived. Now, this isn't official. This is just what WrestleVotes was claiming they heard from a source. But it would make sense if it was a trade, given what they did with Aaliyah on the show. Caden Carter and Casey Catanzaro got a win over Aaliyah and Jesse Kamea. Again, representing the Robert Stone brand. After the match, Aaliyah shoved Stone away. She yelled that she's done more for him than he's done for her, which is debatable. And then she slapped him and beat the crap out of him while Kamea just watched on from the outside. Aaliyah walked right past her on the way out. She got cheers, she got applause from the crowd, people were actually chanting her name. That's the first time I've ever heard chants of Aaliyah from an NXT crowd. So that may have been her final appearance on NXT. It felt like maybe it was. Remember when Chelsea Green was with Robert Stone and she fired him in a backstage segment, but then she never made another appearance on NXT. She was being called up to the main roster until she got hurt again, and then they fired her right when she was ready to come back. But anyway, Frankie Monet walked out and Jesse Kamea left with her. Robert Stone was following right behind them. Later on backstage, Mandy Rose walked up to Monet and Kamea and Stone and said, well, looks like the Robert Stone brand is under new management. That being Frankie Monet. So it appears, much like Raw of late, the Robert Stone brand is a dead brand. But we'll have to wait and see why Mandy Rose is there and how she factors into all of this. What it does mean is the breakup of yet another tag team. Dana Brooke and Mandy Rose, who as recently as this past Monday were still being teased for a women's tag team title match with Natty and Tamina, and now they are no more. Which only leaves Shotzi Blackheart and Tegan Nox as the only babyface team left to challenge for the titles. Right? Because Lana was gone, so no more Lana and Naomi. I mean, I'm not going to shed any tears for the breakup of either of these teams. But they need teams. Santos Escobar picked up a win over Dexter Lumis with some help from Legado del Fantasma. Lumis is better in smaller doses. We haven't seen too much of him lately, which is good. He shouldn't be overexposed, especially because he doesn't speak. Hit Row walked out to confront Legado on stage as they were headed to the back. Yeah, I was going to say two heel factions, but Hit Row is a babyface group to me. They've been one of the most refreshing things on this show for weeks now. I mean, I'm down for a 3-on-3. Indy Hartwell then came out to return the favor to Lumis after he had come to the ring. Remember when Indy and Candice lost their NXT Women's Tag Team titles? Out came Dexter to lift up Indy Hartwell and carry her to the back, like something out of a romantic film or some kind of Disney cartoon. Beauty and the Beast. Indy Hartwell came out to return the favor. She tried to do the same thing. She lifted him up and went to go carry him to the back, and then she dropped him. And then as they gazed into each other's eyes on the ground, she closed hers and she went to go plant a wet one on him. When Candice LeRae came out, she interrupted their special moment. I like the way they've been teasing this out. I mean, it's a minor side story. It's not a major storyline. You do need these small little side stories, though. It's been going on for a while now. It might actually lead to Hartwell getting him to speak his first words on the show. He can't be a mute forever. He's going to have to speak at some point. This could be their way to do it. Like when X-Pac got Kane to say his first words on Raw. And Dexter Lumis would become the biggest babyface in NXT history if his first words to Indy Hartwell were the same as Kane's first words on Raw. I mean, it wouldn't be very PG, but my God, he'd be the biggest fucking babyface in all of wrestling. We had our first match in the NXT Breakout Tournament with Duke Hudson, former Brendan Vink, beating Ikemen Jiro. Is it Ikemen or Ikemen? I'm going to say Ikemen. Ikemen Jiro, trained by Tajiri and the Great Muta. Jiro is very charismatic. He wore this colorful jacket during the match. Kind of reminded me of Hiromu a little bit in New Japan. I find him to be more interesting than Duke Hudson over here. Hudson has to be a favorite to win the entire thing. I know he is favored by some people. I'm going with Carmelo Hayes. He's my pick to win the tournament. I would have preferred to see Jiro get the win here and go a little bit further in the tournament. Not win the whole thing, but just go to the next round at least. But Hudson won with a Boss Man Slam, which I was happy to hear Vic, Joseph, refer to it by that name. Wade Barrett was not too happy on commentary. He reminded Vic that he used to use, that used to be my move, he said. I used to call that the Winds of Change. Yeah, but Boss Man had it first, so pipe down there, Wade. Speaking of Wade, he had a taped sit-down interview with Kyle O'Reilly, asking him about his loss last week to Adam Cole, and sure enough, this feud must continue, which we knew. His attitude about the loss was basically, well, losses are part of the business. Spoken like a true loser. He said he didn't have the killer instinct that he needed to win, but one of these days, he and Cole are going to meet again, and he will be the man not to beat Adam Cole, but to finish Adam Cole. And Cole later had an in-ring promo where he mocked O'Reilly for losing and said Kyle's win over him was unsanctioned, so that doesn't count from their first match, which is true. It should not count. That's why Britt Baker is the AEW Women's Champion right now and not Thunder Rosa. Because Thunder Rosa's win over her was in an unsanctioned match. See, Cole is learning. He is learning from his better half. But I have a theory about where all of this... I have an Austin theory here about where this all may be heading. I'm going to wait until the end, though, to say what it is. But Cole called out Samoa Joe. He got Bronson Reed instead. He said he no longer has his NXT North American Championship, and therefore he no longer has anything to lose. I mean, that's one way to look at it, I guess. If you lose your championship, well, I've got nothing to lose. Cole went to go super kick him, but he caught his foot. Reed went for a lariat, Cole ducked it, and then he got run over by Reed, like running into a brick wall, and Adam Cole bailed. And out comes Samoa Joe, in his referee shirt for the main event, Johnny Gargano against Karrion Kross for the NXT Championship. Joe called it right down the middle. There was lots of tension between him and Kross during the match, really throughout the entire show, not just the match. Kross had his cross jacket sleeper on Gargano, who got a rope break. Kross refused to break the hold, and Joe violently pulled off Kross, pulled him off of Gargano. They got face to face, but Kross walked away. So then he grabbed Gargano by the throat. He starts slamming him into the barricade, into the plexiglass on the outside. Kross picked up the ring steps. He was going to use them as a weapon, and Joe grabbed the steps away from him, which allowed Gargano to DDT Karrion Kross on the floor. Gargano nailed his one final beat DDT. Kross kicked out. And then Kross powerbombed Gargano three times, hit a Saito suplex, and he clubbed Johnny right in the back of the head with a forearm strike, and Joe counted the three. So Karrion Kross retains the NXT Championship. He and Joe have yet another stare down, and when Joe turns to go walk away and leave, Karrion Kross grabs Samoa Joe and chokes him out. And he is screaming the whole time, "You brought this on yourself, Joe. You brought this on yourself." Now, my first thought was, this is great. Joe must be cleared. He's getting physical. Look at this. He didn't take a bump, but, you know, he's in there getting physical. They're blatantly teasing something with him and Kross. Clearly, he is okay to wrestle. It's going to be Joe now challenging Karrion Kross for the championship at TakeOver. And I think if Samoa Joe is cleared, he is totally wrestling Karrion Kross, right? That seems pretty obvious. But we don't know that Joe is cleared. It's possible he is, and they have kept it a secret, but we don't know that he's cleared. And the more I think about it, and what Kyle O'Reilly said about Adam Cole and them preparing for one final match, Kross, we know he's been wrestling matches on Main Event and dark matches. He's preparing for a move to the main roster soon. I think it's actually more likely that Samoa Joe is not yet cleared, and Karrion Kross attacking him is going to be their way of stripping Karrion Kross of the NXT Championship and getting that belt off of him without having to actually beat him for it. I'd much rather see him in a match, but look at what they did here. He attacked an NXT official. You can't do that. If Joe isn't cleared, Kross gets stripped, possibly expelled from NXT, which means the NXT Championship is held in abeyance. Remember, WWE loved that expression a few years ago. The title is in abeyance. That was their favorite word when the title was vacant. And I think the third and final Adam Cole Kyle O'Reilly match is contested at TakeOver then to crown a new NXT champion, with Kyle O'Reilly getting the big win. The big babyface win. He finally wins the big one after all the times he failed, because he had two or three different opportunities against Finn Balor. He lost them all. So this could be his big moment that they're setting up for. I am personally not a fan of Kyle O'Reilly as the NXT champion, but people like him. I don't hate the guy. I just don't see him as somebody who should be in that role as the NXT champion. But again, people like him, and it would be a nice moment to close out that show with him getting the conquering win over Adam Cole and having something tangible to show for it. That's where I think this is leading. We'll know this week because, you know, Tuesday they're going to go on the air, and if there's no punishment for Karrion Kross, if he's not stripped this week, then obviously it's building to a match of some kind. By the way, the July 27th and August 3rd episodes of NXT back-to-back weeks will not be airing on USA Network. They are being bounced for beach volleyball and table tennis. And they're going to air in their usual 8 p.m. slot, but it'll be on Sci-Fi Network instead. So you have the fan-free Tokyo Olympics to thank for that.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, we go back 37 years ago. This week on July 14th, 1984, what would come to be known as Black Saturday took place. Now just imagine, picture it for a moment here, just imagine being a huge fan of NWA wrestling, watching faithfully on TBS every Saturday at 6:05, when suddenly one week you turn on the show and instead of seeing Gordon Solie's face, you see Vince McMahon hosting the show, throwing it to footage of his WWF matches. You probably would not be very happy about that. The Briscoe brothers, Jerry and Jack, they played a big role in all of this. Vince McMahon was looking to expand his presence nationally beyond his slot on the USA Network. And Georgia Championship Wrestling was the only other promotion with a national cable slot. And McMahon had made an offer to Ted Turner for the slot previously, and Turner had rejected him. And it wasn't long after that, Vince got wind of all the turmoil behind the scenes that was going on. GCW had multiple stakeholders. Ole Anderson had a minor stake in it, and he was also serving as the head booker. And the other owners were not very happy with some of the things and the decisions that Ole was making. So Vince McMahon approached those other owners, which included the Briscoes. They and Jim Barnett all agreed to sell their stakes to Vince McMahon for some $900,000, which gave him controlling interest, about 90%, and there was nothing Ole could do about it. They went behind Ole's back and they did this. That gave McMahon access to the Saturday time slot on TBS. And the complaints came in fast and furious from angry viewers. They sent in thousands of phone calls and letters. They did not like the WWF style of wrestling. It ran counter to what they loved about the NWA. And they loved Gordon Solie and they wanted him back as well. In response, Turner made deals to air Mid-South Wrestling and other Southern wrestling programs and other slots that trounced the Saturday show in the ratings. Vince responded the only way he knows how. He tried to stick it to them by airing primarily reruns of matches that had already aired in either on USA Network or on their syndicated shows, which is not what was promised when he made the deal. There were supposed to be matches airing from the studios at TBS. The whole thing was a disaster, financially and otherwise. Vince McMahon ended up selling the time slot to Jim Crockett Jr. for $1 million. Famous story, he allegedly told him, "I'm going to make you choke on that million." Jerry Briscoe admits that Vince brought Gorilla Monsoon with him to the studio that first day just in case things went sideways. He was kind of walking into the lion's den. He didn't know what he was walking into. So he brought the gorilla with him as his bodyguard. But Briscoe got a job with Vince out of it for 36 years before he got released last year. 33 years ago this week on July 16th, 1988, Bruiser Brody was fatally stabbed in a shower stall in a locker room in Bayamon, Puerto Rico, though, he did not die from his injuries until early the next morning. The incident took place on the 16th. He was 42 years old. One of wrestling's great tragedies, that this man, one of the most famous performers in the business at that time, he may not have been friendly to all promoters. He had a reputation for being a little difficult to work with, depending on who he worked for, but well-respected, very successful. Like I said, one of the biggest names in the business who I think it was inevitable at some point would have gone on to work for Vince McMahon. Would it have worked out? Who knows? Because Brody was known, if he was working somewhere and things weren't going the way that he wanted it to go, he would pack his shit and leave. But that's always been one of those what-if questions. What if Brody had gone to New York? What if Brody had gone to work for Vince in the late 80s and worked a program with Hogan? Well, I mean, if he did, I think we all know how that would have ended. It would have ended like every other Hogan program would have ended. But we'll never know. But one of the great tragedies is that you have this man and he is laying there on the floor in the locker room, bleeding out and dying. And the bastard got away with it. I've talked about the Brody murder in great detail. I also covered the Dark Side of the Ring episode, so I won't get into all of it again. You can go back and find those episodes. But it took almost an hour for the ambulance to even get to the building. Tony Atlas was there. He saw Jose Gonzalez, Invader number one, holding the bloody knife in his hand. Atlas then had to carry Brody because he was such a big man. He carried him to the ambulance. According to Dutch Mantel, who was there that night at the show, Brody underwent two operations. It was during the second one that he bled to death on the operating table. He believes that if he was treated in an American hospital, he would have had a much better chance of surviving. Gonzalez was initially charged with first-degree murder, but that was downgraded to involuntary homicide. And he was later acquitted by a majority vote. So, you know, their judicial system over there, at least at that time in Puerto Rico, is quite different than it is here in the States. There was no jury trial or anything like that. But he was acquitted. And Gonzalez was part owner of the World Wrestling Council in Puerto Rico at that time. Carlos Colon was the principal owner. A lot of people believe that Colon had a hand, if not in plotting the murder itself, then at least helping to cover it up. The murder weapon also mysteriously vanished. It was never recovered. And Mantell and Atlas have talked about, and maybe others have talked about, waiting for summonses to be sent to them so that they can come back to Puerto Rico and testify at Gonzalez's trial, because they talked to the police. Atlas talked to the police and gave his account of things, what he saw. He was just waiting to get a summons, and he was going to go and testify. And I mean, maybe some people wouldn't have because they would have been afraid to. But the point is, for all this waiting for a summons, they didn't come until after the trial had already been completed. Then they arrived in the mail. Meanwhile, the trial was over. Imagine that. Fuck Jose Gonzalez and fuck Carlos Colon. I left my seat to go take a piss when WWE inducted him into the Hall of Fame in 2014. 31 years ago this week, on July 16th, 1990, WWE taped its 27th edition of Saturday Night's Main Event, dubbed Wild Kingdom, from Omaha, Nebraska, which aired on NBC on July 28th. This show set the stage for the double main event at SummerSlam the following month, with the Ultimate Warrior defending the WWE Championship against Ravishing Rick Rude, and Hulk Hogan making his return to challenge Earthquake to a match. Bobby Heenan interfered in the Rude match, which opened the show, leading to a disqualification, and the two would meet again for the title in a steel cage at SummerSlam. While on this show, Vince McMahon introduced Hulk Hogan for his first appearance since he was squashed, literally squashed, by Earthquake on the Brother Love show months earlier. You have got to see this Hogan tribute video they aired before he came out. It was quite the tearjerker. This was to Hogan what Tell Me a Lie, what that video was years later to Shawn Michaels. Earthquake and Dino Bravo came out after Hogan's promo to attack. They surrounded him. They surrounded the ring. But Tugboat ran down to save the Hulkster. This is when they were trying to give Tugboat a push by associating him with Hogan. He was a friend of Hogan's. He ended up not even being in Hogan's corner at SummerSlam. They wrote him off in an injury angle on TV, and they put the Big Boss Man with Hogan instead. The Boss Man was much more over than Tugboat was anyway. Demolition beat the Rockers, which led to the Hart Foundation coming out and trying to tell the referee that the illegal member of Demolition got the pinfall. This is when Smash and Crush were tagging together with Axe in their corner. This then brought out the Legion of Doom to do the same thing. And what a visual this was. I watched this back. This brought a smile to my face. This scene right here is tag team wrestling for me. We had Demolition, we had the Rockers, we had the Hart Foundation, we had LOD, all in and around the ring at the same time. If this had happened years later, we would have gotten a Fatal 4-Way at SummerSlam that year. But they didn't do Fatal 4-Ways back then. We didn't have Fatal 4-Ways, we didn't have Triple Threats, we didn't have any of this stuff. There was no Money in the Bank cash-ins. You had to earn your way to a championship match. So we never did get that Fatal 4-Way. Mr. Perfect retained his Intercontinental title over Tito Santana. This was a fabulous match. This is one of my favorite matches ever on Saturday Night's Main Event. The near falls in this match had everybody convinced that Tito was winning the belt. This was so great. This match is a lost gem that does not get talked about enough. 4-star match. If you've never seen it, it's worth seeking out this episode just to watch that match. And we had the debut of the Texas Tornado. Kerry Von Erich with a win over Playboy Buddy Rose. This was one of my favorite editions of Saturday Night's Main Event. And sadly, the final one with Jesse the Body Ventura and Vince McMahon together on commentary, because Jesse would be fired the following month after a dispute with McMahon over a video game. Jesse had a standing offer to do a video game, which he did end up doing. It was a game based around his likeness. I believe the issue may have been that it was a Sega game and WWE had an existing deal with Nintendo at that time. But whatever it was around that game. It led to a bigger rift between the two. Jesse made it very clear that you don't own me. And that was the end of Jesse Ventura in WWE. He sued them in court the following year over royalty payments that he felt he was owed, and he won. The first person, maybe the only person ever, to take Vince McMahon to court and win. 30 years ago this week, on July 14th, 1991, WCW put on one of the worst pay-per-views in wrestling history with the Great American Bash from Baltimore. It was to have been Ric Flair defending his WCW World Heavyweight Championship against Lex Luger inside a steel cage. But all of the drama that I documented previously went down between Flair and Jim Herd, and Flair quit the promotion, or he was fired, depending on who you believe. And he took the big gold belt with him. Instead, Luger won the vacant title from Barry Windham in a cage, while fans chanted, "We want Flair." Some fans walked out. This show was a disaster, not just for that reason, but just up and down the card. Terrible match after terrible match. Kevin Nash was playing the Oz character at that time here, after Turner had acquired the rights to the Wizard of Oz, but he suffered his first loss to Ron Simmons, and that was the end of the Oz character. After that, Nash says that if it wasn't for Dusty Rhodes and that Oz gimmick, he never would have made it in the business. As bad as it was in the States, he said that gimmick got over huge in Japan, and it helped him, in his words, find his way. Yeah, well, maybe so, but it still sucked. Main event was to have been a mixed tag team match with Rick Steiner and Missy Hyatt taking on Arn Anderson and Paul E. Dangerously, also in a cage. Instead, it turned into a handicap match when Dick Murdoch and Dick Slater came out before the match and kidnapped Missy Hyatt. Against her will, they kidnapped this poor woman. They took her to the back. There was a fan in the aisleway as they're carrying her away from the ring who took a swing at Murdoch. And I don't know why you would want to take a swing at Dick Murdoch, but this guy took a swing at him. And Murdoch dropped Missy when he let go of her to go take a swing at the guy, who's very lucky that he whiffed, or else he would have been out cold. Steiner gave Arn Anderson a Steiner line. He did the same to Paul Heyman to win the match in 2 minutes. It was over. What happened is that the Maryland State Athletic Commission had, and I believe still to this day has, a rule on the books prohibiting male against female matches. WWE was, they were aware of this rule when they booked Vince McMahon to wrestle his daughter at No Mercy back in 2003. They just paid the fine in advance so they could do the match. Because that's all the commission cares about. As long as they get paid, that's all that matters. WCW either didn't know about the rule or they didn't give a shit and they advertised the match anyway. Either scenario is plausible. 29 years ago this week, on July 12th, 1992, WCW presented its Great American Bash pay-per-view from Albany, Georgia. The final Great American Bash until 1995, highlighted by an excellent match between Sting and Vader for the WCW World Championship. This was Vader's first WCW title win. Sting hit his head on the metal bar that connects the top turnbuckle to the ring post on a Stinger splash in the corner. And a short time later, Vader hit a powerbomb and stacked him for the win. I loved the matches that Sting and Vader had. They worked so well together. Whether it was this one, their King of Cable match at Starrcade, their White Castle of Fear strap match at Super Brawl the following year. You know, everybody talks about the Flair Steamboat trilogy, but the Sting Vader trilogy deserves a mention too. I'm not saying it's better than Flair Steamboat, but it definitely deserves a mention. But Vader would not have the title for long. He dropped it just 3 weeks later to Ron Simmons. There was some controversy locally. They had 8,000 fans packed into the Civic Center for the show, only half of which were paid. The other half were freebies in the form of coupons, and they gave away so many of them that they had to turn a lot of people away, some of whom had been waiting outside the venue since 9 o'clock in the morning, only to be sent home. Situation was bad enough that it made the local news, so they basically did what the airlines do. They overbooked. They overbooked and they fucked over a whole bunch of people. 27 years ago this week, on July 17th, 1994, at the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view, Hulk Hogan made his in-ring debut for World Championship Wrestling. This was after the big ticker tape parade in Orlando that he got the month prior. This was also the first ever nationally televised match between Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. There was at least one Hogan-Flair match that aired on television. It was locally on MSG Network in late 91 in WWE. But never did the two of them have a singles match one-on-one that aired on television or on pay-per-view on a national basis. As crazy as that sounds, given that Flair was in WWE for a good year and a half, the match was teased for WrestleMania 8, although never actually planned. It's still, you know, one of those matches that didn't happen but should have at that time, but it happened in WCW, and it went exactly the way you would have expected it to go. Hogan and Flair, they worked what was actually a pretty good match, but of course Hogan no-sold a lot of his shit. He won with the big leg, he became the new champion. This was also the last of Jesse Ventura in WCW. He had been doing announcing for them since 92. I don't think it is a coincidence that Jesse's run here ended when Hogan came into the company. Hogan and Jesse had always been friends. They'd always gotten along, but it was years later in a deposition when Ventura learned that Hogan was the one who ratted him out when he tried to get the boys together and unionize back in 86. You know, Ventura didn't know that it was Hogan who ratted him out until he had his lawyer ask Vince McMahon about it under oath in a deposition about something completely unrelated. But he goes, hey, go ahead and ask McMahon about this other thing. Because he had always wondered, how is it that Vince found out that I had given this speech in the locker room that night? There was nobody else around. The agents weren't there. Vince wasn't there. How did he find out? Because Vince called up Ventura and threatened to fire him and yelled at him when he found out what he had tried to do. This was right before WrestleMania 2. So once he had Vince in a deposition about the royalty stuff, he told his lawyer, look, ask him this other question. That's when Vince said, without even batting an eye, he goes, oh, because Hogan told me. He said, Hogan told me. Hogan told me what Jesse had done. From that point on, there was no love lost. Ventura had no love lost for Hogan. In fact, he was calling some of the action, I think, on the show. He was working the show, but he did not work the main event. He did not work Hogan's match. So again, I don't think that was a coincidence. I don't think that was by accident. But Hogan he had compiled over the years quite the record for himself at Bash at the Beach. He competed in 5 out of the 7 main events on these Bash at the Beach shows. He won the championship here in his very first one from Ric Flair in 94. He successfully defended the title against Vader in a cage the following year. In 96, he showed up, he turned heel, he helped form the New World Order. He tagged with Dennis Rodman in the main event in 97 and again in 98. And then in 2000, it wasn't the main event, but he won the world title from Jeff Jarrett with the whole Russo work shoot thing that went on. Then it was nullified and he left the company. Hogan never came back. I would say that it is fair to call Hulk Hogan Mr. Bash at the Beach. You know, we kind of assign these titles to people. Shawn Michaels, Mr. WrestleMania. For years, I've said Bret Hart is Mr. SummerSlam. Randy Orton, I once said Randy Orton is Mr. Survivor Series, and John Cena was Mr. Royal Rumble. When you look at the success that these guys have had on these shows, Hulk Hogan was Mr. Bash at the Beach. 3 days earlier, 3 days before this, before he won his first WCW championship, Hogan was in a courtroom in Long Island, New York, testifying under immunity from prosecution at the Vince McMahon steroid trial. He said that he would call Vince's secretary to place orders for him with Dr. Zahorian, and that when his roids would arrive at Titan Tower, he would pick them up with his paycheck and his fan mail. I can just picture it now. Hogan strolling into the office. Got my check? Here you go, Terry. You got my fan letters from all my Hulkamaniacs? Here you go. You got a stack of mail right here. You got my steroids? You got my candy? You got my syringes? Yeah, they're in that brown bag right over there. You just pick everything up all at once. How convenient. It doesn't get any more convenient than that. He claimed he took anabolic steroids not only for bodybuilding purposes but to heal injuries, and that he no longer uses them. And he said that he believed it was legal because he had a prescription for it. This would have been even after they became illegal. He thought they were legal because he had a prescription. He also said Vince McMahon never ordered him to take steroids and never purchased any steroids for him. 26 years ago this week, on July 16th, 1995, WCW held its Bash at the Beach pay-per-view on an actual beach. Outdoors in Huntington Beach, California, with fans free to stop on by and watch the show at no charge. The old no gate, just like those Road Wild pay-per-views. No gates, just drive your motorcycle up. We're going to make $0 off the gate on these shows. Tony Schiavone tried to claim more than 100,000 people were in attendance, but you can shave a zero off of that and get a more accurate number. Maybe there were 10,000. I mean, look, I know all companies exaggerate, but that is just ridiculous. There's exaggeration and then there's just whatever the hell this was. Before the main card began, we had a Hulk Hogan interview where he was interrupted by this giant man, Paul White, making his debut appearance, throwing a t-shirt at Hogan and asking him, "Remember this?" And Hogan looks at the shirt and he says, "That's Andre's." This was the setup, the giant being referred to as the son of Andre the Giant, which was quickly dropped. Randy Savage beat Ric Flair in a lifeguard lumberjack match, and Hulk Hogan beat Vader in a steel cage match in the main event using the escape the cage rule, which WCW did not traditionally use. That was a WWE thing. You escape the cage, both feet touch the floor. That's not how it used to work in the NWA and WCW. The cage was put around the ring to keep the people in, keep other people out, but you had pinfall and submission that usually counted in the cage. I know Jim Ross loves to talk about how much he hates that rule, escape the cage. It's almost like you're running away from your opponent. I grew up on the whole escape the cage thing because I was a WWF fan. So the blue bar cage, climbing out of the cage, I don't have as much of an issue with it. I mean, I can understand if you're a traditionalist, thinking that way and not liking that rule. But the only reason they did that rule here, so you might, well, then why'd they do it here in WCW if they didn't usually do that? Vader would not do a clean job for Hulk Hogan. The entire time they feuded, he would not do a clean job for him because he knew that Hogan was not going to do the same for him. So he said, "Fuck him. You're not jobbing me out." It ended up being Vader's final WCW pay-per-view match. Because it was not long after this that Vader got into the backstage fight with Paul Orndorff that I mentioned earlier during my tribute to Orndorff, who just passed away. And he was gone from the company after that, and a few months later he was in WWE. 24 years ago this week, on the July 14th, 1997 episode of Raw is War, Mick Foley debuted his Dude Love character on TV as Steve Austin's mystery partner, beating Owen Hart and the British Bulldog to win the WWF Tag Team titles, which had been vacated after Shawn Michaels, who was champion with Austin, got into his little backstage scuffle weeks earlier with Bret Hart. 23 years ago this week, on July 12th, 1998, WCW presented its Bash at the Beach pay-per-view from San Diego, California, with over 500,000 homes tuned in, making it their most watched pay-per-view of the year. Unfortunately, it was also one of their worst, with Hollywood Hogan and Dennis Rodman beating Diamond Dallas Page and Karl Malone in the main event. This was days after Hogan lost the WCW World title to Goldberg on Nitro. Goldberg on this show defended his title successfully in 3 minutes against Curt Hennig. Squashed Hennig in a minute on Nitro the next night. Rodman and Malone had just played against each other in the NBA Finals, the Bulls against the Jazz. So it was great publicity for WCW, especially when the two of them got physical in Game 6, which led to Mr. Holier-than-thou himself, Bob Costas, famously trashing pro wrestling on commentary after Rodman got called for his third flagrant foul during the game. Costas said, "He and Karl Malone, regrettably, are scheduled to wrestle in one of those bogus events next month." Why Malone wants to lower himself to that is anyone's guess, and Rodman apparently wants to start the wrestling now. That was Bob Costas. Malone was a pro wrestling fan from the days that his mom would take him and his siblings to the matches in Louisiana. Along the way, he had become friends with DDP. And DDP dreamt up this idea for a tag team match where it would be him and Malone against Hogan and Rodman. And he pitched it to Eric Bischoff, who he was, you know, very friendly with. He was at Eric's house, and he pitched the idea to Eric. And Bischoff thought about it, and he went, "Wow, Hogan and Rodman against Savage and Malone. That's awesome." And DDP said, "Maybe you didn't hear me. Me and Malone." He said, "Because this is my connection, and I'm not giving it to anybody. He's my friend." So instead of Randy Savage, DDP got this, and good for him, by the way. I mean, you know, he came up with the idea. He had the relationship with Malone. It should have been him. He was over enough to justify it. So he got the spot. Rodman was embarrassing here. He showed up in no condition to perform. He was in there screwing up spots left and right. At one point, he laid his head down on the turnbuckle and appeared to be taking a nap. Dean Malenko said Rodman is one of the only people in the history of the business to fall asleep during their match. I'm pretty sure Andre fell asleep during some of his matches too. $750,000 is what they paid this guy for all of this, plus whatever additional money he was owed. Karl Malone, he looked like he had actually trained and prepared and put time and effort into this. But a week before this, Rodman famously crashed a Pearl Jam concert with no shirt on, no shoes on. He was drinking from a bottle of wine. He jumped up on stage. He joined the band. And he stayed on stage with them for 45 minutes, singing along to various songs, or interrupting them is probably more accurate, until they finally got sick of him and they cut his mic off. Stone Gossard told him, "Get the fuck off the stage." Eddie Vedder said, "Well, I guess you've been drinking for 3 days straight." That tells you all you need to know about the state that Rodman was in for this show. Rodman in WCW was still a big deal, but his time there in 97, the first time he came in for a big program like this with the NWO, was much better than whatever they got from him in 98. Especially that Voodoo Child entrance he did with Hogan on Nitro that one time. Rodman filed suit against WCW that October, claiming he was not paid what he was promised on his contracts with the company. And that case was dismissed the following year. The next night, on the July 13th episode of Raw is War from the Continental Airlines Arena in East Rutherford, New Jersey, or the Meadowlands, as I still call it, Shawn Michaels made his first appearance on television since losing the WWF title to Steve Austin at WrestleMania. He did commentary for the show, including the opening match, which saw Undertaker nearly get his face burned off when he did the deal on the ring steps where he threw his arms up in the air to turn the lights back on in the arena, and Kane's pyro accidentally shot out of the same ring post he was standing in front of. That was very scary. Undertaker has had some bad experiences with the pyro guys over the years. Kane and Mankind also won the tag team titles from the New Age Outlaws, and Owen Hart ran down to the ring to beat the fuck out of Jason Sensation, who was doing a funny impersonation of him on commentary. Thankfully, Owen was a lot nicer to this Jason when I met him before the show. This was my very first live Raw experience. I had won luxury box seats from a local radio station, got to meet Mick Foley, Owen Hart, Mark Henry, Luna Vachon, who came into our box about an hour before Raw went live. They were taping something at the, while they were going from box to box, they were taping, I guess back then in 98, what would it have been? They still taping Shotgun? One of those syndicated shows they were taping. But they could not have been nicer. Mick, of course, looked like he had been in a car wreck, which is not surprising, given that he was only 2 weeks removed from the Hell in a Cell match against The Undertaker. But I am very glad I got to meet Owen and get a picture with him less than a year before his death. 19 years ago, this week, on July 15th, 2002, hell froze over when Vince McMahon introduced Eric Bischoff as the new general manager of Monday Night Raw. There was a pitch to bring Bischoff in a year earlier, but it didn't work out. You really needed Bischoff to make the invasion work properly. You needed him and a handful of headliners from WCW. You didn't need all of them, but just some big names along with Eric. It would not have been difficult to come up with a proper invasion story using that cluster of people that could have made everybody a lot of money. But I guess they were not willing to take the risk. Some of those talents were that the money would be more than what they were making sitting on their ass at home working off their contracts with Turner. I'm not even saying I blame them for feeling that way. If it's guaranteed money and you don't have to do anything for it. But that's what you needed to make that story work. The deal came together not long before he debuted. Only a matter of weeks, really. To avoid any leaks, he even told Vince McMahon that he would fly himself in and book his own hotel because the minute his office books his airline ticket, he told Vince, everybody is going to know. And Vince said, you're right. So that's what they did. He booked his own flight, he booked his own hotel, and he waited for word from them on when and where to be. This is what he said in his book, Controversy Creates Cash. The Raw I was going to appear on was at the Continental Airlines Arena in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Well, look at that. There you go. Another famous Raw from the Meadowlands. I came into New York City and stayed across the river near LaGuardia Airport. Monday morning, a town car came over and picked me up, bringing me to another hotel not far from the arena, but not the one where the wrestlers were staying. Around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, a script was slipped under my door. There were 2 or 3 pages of material they wanted me to memorize. Up until then, I had never had to memorize that much material. Usually, I'd work with bullet points and improve it. That's the way a lot of guys who have been in the business for a while work. I wasn't sure whether they wanted it word for word or not, but I figured if they spent this much time preparing this much script, I'd better do it word for word. For the next few hours, I walked back and forth in my room, talking to myself, reciting my lines. About 7 o'clock, a stretch limo arrived in my hotel to take me to the arena. We stayed out in the parking lot outside the venue until 9. Then the limo pulled inside the arena and I remained inside so no one could see me. And one of the things that I remember about watching this segment was the fact that they spoiled it, going into the commercial. They were doing a backstage interview with Booker T, right? It was Coach and Booker looked over and he had the shocked look on his face. And they pan back and there's Eric Bischoff. And then he walks off camera and Booker goes, tell me I didn't just see that. And they went to commercial. Now they did it, I'm sure, because they wanted word to spread quickly. Holy shit, put USA on or whatever network they were on back then. I guess 2002 was probably still TNN. But they wanted people to know that Bischoff was going to be on the show and maybe they would pop a big number for it. But I thought that was incredibly stupid. It would have been more shocking if they didn't trot him out there right before Vince McMahon came out to make the announcement. But it was still one of the most shocking moments in Raw history. As Jerry Lawler said on commentary, he used to sit next to Vince McMahon on those Raw shows where he would wish death upon Bischoff. Probably when he would give away the Raw results on Nitro. I know that because it used to really piss me off. I can imagine how it must have made Vince McMahon feel. But out comes Vince McMahon to make the announcement. He goes from one son of a bitch to another. He introduces Eric Bischoff, who came out to AC/DC's Back in Black on the original broadcast. Every other version of it that you'll find It's got his WWE music dubbed in. But they did use AC/DC on that first show. And Bischoff ended up working for them for a number of years. He was there for a good, 3 years, I think it was. It was later on in 2005 when they did the angle where he was literally thrown out into the trash. He was thrown into the back of a garbage truck on Raw, which was quite a way for his run there to end, but appropriate, I'd say, in some ways. But Bischoff was one of the best Raw GMs they had, you know, as an on-air character. He was great in that role. And he ended up having a nice role for himself in the company. 16 years ago this week, on July 13th, 2005, the UPN Network, which was then the home of SmackDown, requested that WWE pull the Muhammad Hassan character from the show after a huge controversy erupted the week prior. Hassan, really more than anything, was a victim of poor timing. The week before, on the July 7th episode of SmackDown, Undertaker had a match against Hassan's manager, Daivari. After the match, Hassan dropped to his knees, he began to pray, when five men in black ski masks ran in and they beat down the Undertaker. And one of them pulled out a piece of piano wire, began choking him, and they carried Daivari's body from the ring, in Taz's words, like a martyr. Right? This is the language they use. This is what they wanted you to think. It was clear what they were going for. And if this aired on any other night, nobody outside of the wrestling bubble, I think, would have said a word. But the angle aired on the same day as the London terror bombings. So it wasn't a case of WWE doing this angle to try to exploit the attacks, you know, hours after they happened. The show had already been taped a few days before. Now, UPN did air a statement warning the segment would be controversial, but what they should have done is just cut the segment. They had enough time to either have WWE film something and stick it in there, or just air an old match, but they should have cut it. And they didn't. And the mainstream media jumped all over him. And it wasn't WWE that paid a price for it. It was Mark Copani, who portrayed Muhammad Hassan, who did nothing wrong. He did his job. He was a young guy, green guy, playing a character on television, doing his job, playing a part, and he was banished from SmackDown. I would imagine USA Network felt the same way, which is why they didn't just move him over to Raw. He had already been on Raw. He was literally just moved over from Raw to SmackDown. So either they didn't want to move him right back to Raw, because creatively they had just gotten him off the show, or again, maybe USA didn't want to have any part of this either. But the angle itself was really stupid, and it was done for shock value. Hassan's character, and here's why it was stupid. Hassan's character was he was an Arab American who protested the prejudice. Remember all those opening vignettes when he first debuted? He's an Arab American who is protesting the prejudices that Americans had towards other Arab Americans after 9/11. They were playing off real life, and not only was that a real thing, but I think it continues to be a real thing to this day. So that's how he was introduced and how people looked down at him based on how he looked and how he dressed. That was the character. Until now, where they have, in this angle here, a bunch of nameless, faceless terrorists, basically, run in to beat up The Undertaker, all led by Muhammad Hassan, which goes against everything the character was about. It was done purely for shock value, and they picked the wrong night to do it, and it bit them on the ass. But it also killed Copani's career. UPN decided they didn't want him on the show anymore. He was scheduled to wrestle The Undertaker at the Great American Bash in a number one contenders match, with the winner challenging Batista for the world championship at SummerSlam in the nation's capital and Batista's hometown of Washington, D.C. Instead, Undertaker beat him at the pay-per-view, gave him a last ride powerbomb from the stage down through the stage, basically onto the concrete, to write off the character for good. They sent him and Daivari back to Ohio Valley Wrestling, and then ultimately they released him. So he didn't do anything wrong. He ends up losing his push. He gets sent back down to developmental. And then he gets fired. I'd say he got a raw deal. Even if you didn't like the character, I think it's fair to say he got a raw deal. Meanwhile, Undertaker lost a match on SmackDown, even though he won at the pay-per-view. He went on to lose a match on SmackDown to JBL. That made JBL the number one contender to Batista's title at SummerSlam, which would be a rematch from their title match that they had at the Great American Bash. After his release, Copani retired from wrestling. That was it. His career was over. He was damaged goods. And also, it may have just soured him, frankly, on the whole experience. So he transitioned away from wrestling into education. He went back to college first, and then he went on to become a history teacher and a high school principal. And Copani, in interviews since, and he told this to Chris Van Vliet, in fact, last year, said the plan as he heard it after the fact was for him to beat The Undertaker at that pay-per-view and then go on to SummerSlam and wrestle Batista and win the world championship at SummerSlam in 2004. It was never explicitly said to him that he was going to win the title because they wouldn't have made that decision probably that far out in advance. But he would have gone on to SummerSlam at the very least to challenge for the championship. And Bruce Pritchard has also said that was the plan, that it would have been Batista against Hassan in DC. And the idea of him winning the title was at least being discussed. It had not been decided upon, but it had at least been discussed internally. I can 100% believe that it would have been Hassan against Batista at that pay-per-view, because the character was a heat magnet and he already had a number one contenders match already set up. All he had to do was beat The Undertaker. It would have been far too appealing for them not to give him a world title shot in DC of all places. Now, would he have won the championship? And if so, how well would he have done in the role? I mean, we'll never know because he was never given the chance. He had only debuted in wrestling in 2002 when he went right to OVW. He was still very inexperienced. But in his short time on TV, look at who he got to work with. He got to work with Hulk Hogan. He got to work with Shawn Michaels. He got to work with The Undertaker. This was not some little mid-card character. Although he did get pinned for the first time and squashed by John Cena on Raw right before he got drafted over to SmackDown. Cena was the WWE champion at that time. That was his big send-off from the Red Brand. But if Vince McMahon would put the WWF title on Sergeant Slaughter, the Iraqi sympathizer, because he thought it would be great heel heat, and then they could have the American hero beat him and get the belt back, you don't think he wouldn't have at least considered the same thing with Hassan? Of course he would have. They put the fucking belt on Great Khali 2 years later. Of course they would have done it. But he got screwed, Hassan did, through no fault of his own. And speaking of that, speaking of the Great Khali, 14 years ago this week, the perfect segue, at the SmackDown taping in Laredo, Texas on July 17th, 2007, Edge was forced to forfeit the World Heavyweight Championship due to a torn pec that he had suffered a week earlier, which kept him sidelined until Survivor Series that November. That vacancy would not last long, because later on in the show, the Great Khali won a 20-man battle royal to become the new World Heavyweight Champion. And do not ask Dave Batista about Great Khali holding the big gold belt, because I've heard him talk about it before. I think it makes him physically sick. I don't know that he has anything against Khali as a person, but when I've heard Batista talk about Khali as a world champion in the past, you could hear the pain, the legitimate pain in his voice. 10 years ago this week, you believe it's been 10 years? July 17th, 2011, Money in the Bank. From the Allstate Arena in Chicago, Illinois, Daniel Bryan wins the SmackDown Money in the Bank ladder match. Alberto Del Dipshit wins the Raw Money in the Bank ladder match. Christian wins the World Heavyweight title from Randy Orton on a disqualification. He spat in Randy Orton's face. Per the stipulation, the title could change hands on a DQ, and I think it was Orton who kicked him low. And I've never in my life that I can recall heard this kind of loud positive reaction for a disqualification low blow finish. But that led to Christian winning back the World Heavyweight Championship for the final time. But the thing that this pay-per-view is most remembered for, and rightfully so, and especially being in Chicago, is CM Punk against John Cena for the WWE Championship. Now, CM Punk was not happy. He was not happy in his role in the company at that point. He was still doing the whole straight edge society thing. And he was ready to leave. His contract was legitimately coming up on this date, July 17th. He was out the door. He had already made the decision, I'm going to leave. This ain't working out for me. And he had a title match scheduled with John Cena. And it went right down to the wire. People didn't know if he was going to re-sign or not. They were teasing it like, I'm going to win the championship and I'm going to take the title and go somewhere else. That was the whole pipe bomb promo in Vegas when he sat on the stage and he talked about how I'm going to win the title and I'm going to, maybe I'll bring it to Ring of Honor. Maybe I'll go back to New Japan or I'll go to New Japan Pro Wrestling, right? That's where that's really what kicked all this off was the pipe bomb. And it led to this event here in Chicago. And what it led to is one of the greatest matches in the history of that entire company. It's one of my favorite matches of all time. This could not have happened in a better place than Chicago. Punk came out. He got a hero's welcome. Little did they know that he had signed a new contract with the company that night. Backstage, I believe it was, at the building. He had made the decision. He finally put pen to paper and he re-signed with the company. But they were still playing it up like he hadn't. And that at midnight, he'd be a free agent, possibly with the title. So a lot of people probably thought he's not going to win. Because he's leaving. But he went out there. He got a hero's welcome. John Cena, my God, the heat that this guy had. He kept his head down when he walked to the ring. He wouldn't even make eye contact with anybody in the crowd. It was the closest thing since he made his entrance at the Hammerstein Ballroom for the match at One Night Stand against Rob Van Dam. When he kept his head down, he held the belt up in the air. That's the kind of heat he got in the building that night. Now magnify those 2,500 people in New York City to whatever they had this night. I think it was probably 12 or 13,000. I mean, from the first chord of his music when it hit, the boos, you could feel it reverberate through your body, and I'm just watching it from home on TV. I'm not even there in the building. They had a great match, some great dramatic near falls, especially at one point when it looked like Punk might tap out in the STF, but he got out of it. And then it built to the end where Punk hit the GTS and Cena fell out of the ring, and here comes Vince McMahon and Johnny Ace trying to do what they can, hopefully to preserve the championship and keep the championship safe and sound here in this company. Cena knocks down Johnny Ace. He walks over to Vince McMahon and says, no, we're not going to do it like this. He slides back into the ring, right into the clutches of CM Punk, who drops him with a GTS. And he gets the three. And CM Punk, for the first time, is WWE champion. He'd held the World Heavyweight title a couple of times, but was never WWE champion. He was never the featured guy in this company. And now he was on top of the world. And Vince McMahon tried to send Del Dipshit out to go cash in his money in the bank. He got kicked in the head. Punk went to go leave through the crowd. He blew a kiss to Vince McMahon. He went up and he celebrated in the crowd and walked right out of the building and right out of the company in storyline with the championship. And as great as all of this was, it was like magic watching this match. It was such a pleasure to watch this match and just everybody hanging on to every near fall the way they did. They played this perfectly, but it could have been so much better coming out of the show. They should have kept Punk out a little bit longer. They could have kept or come up with some kind of interim idea if they needed another match to do at SummerSlam. Really sell it. Keep him out a little bit longer. Show him going to a Cubs game, you know, sitting at Wrigley Field or with the title. Have him pop up at various independent shows. Allow him to go pop up at a Ring of Honor show and have the WWE title with him. They really could have played this up so much better than they did, but they got lazy. And he was back on television very, very quickly, far too quickly. Cena had a belt because in the meantime they had crowned the new champion. Punk showed up, so now they have dueling titles. And they went on to have the match at SummerSlam, which Punk won. It was the one with Triple H as the referee, but then Punk, of course, got fucked over by Kevin Nash. It was all downhill. This whole story was all downhill. Kevin Nash powerbombs him. Actually, powerbombed him a whole bunch of times on TV. They never did get their match done. He wrestled Triple H. He lost to Triple H. There was nobody more white hot in wrestling at that point in the fall of 2011 than CM Punk. He did eventually get the belt back. He did eventually turn heel. He did some big things in that company. But you think about the summer of Punk. If you're a CM Punk fan back from the ROH days, you think of Ring of Honor. This was a different kind of summer of Punk. And even though I would have changed a whole bunch of things that they ended up doing, everything that set this match up here at Money in the Bank was just played to perfection. And it delivered in a big way. It's my favorite match the two of them ever had. And like I said, one of the best matches in company history. And 6 years ago this week, on the July 13th, 2015 episode of Monday Night Raw from Atlanta, GA, it was the start of what WWE then referred to as the Divas Revolution, with the Raw debuts of Becky Lynch, Charlotte Flair, and the reigning NXT Women's Champion at that time, Sasha Banks. They would quickly be paired off into groups. At the time, we had Team Bella, which consisted of Alicia Fox and the Bella Twins. We had Team Bad, Naomi, Tamina, and they put Sasha Banks with them. And Team PCB, Paige, Charlotte, and Becky Lynch. Three groups that would all be broken up before the end of the year. Because it would not be WWE without breaking up a bunch of teams as quickly as possible. Even if it was the best, for the best in this case. Because Sasha Banks did not need to be paired off with Naomi and Tamina. These pairings were fucking weird to begin with. I think they were trying to give them rub by putting them together with main roster talents. Meanwhile, these women made their entrances, they made their debuts on this show, and from the moment they walked out, they were bigger stars than almost any of the other people who were in this segment, except maybe the Bellas. They didn't need them. But they were all introduced to the audience on this show by the creator of women's wrestling, All Bow. To the great Stephanie McMahon. What a visionary for women's wrestling she was. This, by the way, was all spurred on. This was the year, in February of that year. There was an infamous match on Raw. It was the Bella Twins against Paige and Emma. And the match went maybe 30 seconds. This was during an era where the Divas, as they were called, they would be lucky to get 30 seconds. They'd be going out for a match and they would tell stories. They're in the gorilla position getting ready to go out for a match that maybe they were going to have 4 or 5 minutes for. And while they're in the gorilla position, they're basically being told to go home. It's like, oh, your match got cut. So counting entrances and everything, you're basically going to have an entrance and then the match within 20 seconds is going to be over. And this was every week. And then you're just like, well, I wonder why people don't give a shit about women's wrestling in this company, because the company didn't give a shit about women's wrestling in this company. They pretended that they did. They acted like they did, but they didn't. That's why I was running the Diva stopwatch gimmick that everybody, you know, started doing the same thing. I started doing the whole Diva stopwatch thing and posting screenshots on my Twitter because it was comical. It's like they were trying to top themselves by breaking records for the shortest match every single week. Well, in this case, it really pissed off a lot of people, and the hashtag #GiveDivasAChance started trending worldwide on Twitter. And if you want to get this company's attention, you got to talk their language. They speak the language of Twitter. They love trending. Don't know that it really means anything. Usually people trend for all the wrong reasons if they say something controversial or if they fucking die. But in this case, Give Divas a Chance was trending. And that got the company's attention. And they started to think about, okay, maybe we ought to actually improve things here. We got to give the people what they want. AJ Lee had made public comments. refuting things that Stephanie McMahon was saying that got a lot of press. So it all built to this moment where they called up some fresh blood, some fresh talent. And by WrestleMania the following year, the Divas title, the Butterfly Belt, was no more. It was now the Women's Championship, and you had Charlotte and Becky and Sasha tearing it up in the ring at WrestleMania. And it really was a changing of the guard. I mean, they love to use words like revolution and stuff, and I know that sounds ridiculous, but for this company, it really was. It really was the start of a revolution of sorts, an overhaul in the women's division and in women's wrestling and how they treated it in this company. And it started with these three women, Charlotte, Becky, and Sasha. And that is this week in wrestling history. Before we end, I just wanted to share this one email that I got from Omar in the Bronx. He wanted me to share this with all of you. He says, first, I want to say thank you for the podcast. I honestly cannot remember when I started to listen to you, but I know it started with a YouTube channel that put clips of your show and others on. Ever since then, I have been a loyal listener. What I really wanted to say was your podcast puts a bright spot on my day and starts my week right. I suffer from anxiety and depression, and before I got my medication correct, I was always fluctuating between sadness and loneliness. I tell you this because in those hard days of everything feeling like the world is going wrong for me, your show gave me that little recharge that kept me going. If it's not too much to ask, I ask that you share this with the rest of the Solo Monster Army, because no matter how bleak and dark life gets, life does get better, and there is light at the end of the tunnel. And I thought that was a very nice email for him to send, and by his request, I wanted to share that. So shout out to Omar. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being a fan and sticking with me. If you have questions or letters, comments you'd like to send, the email address is always the same. I always say it every week. It never changes. It is thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please send in those questions. We'll be doing more of those. And you never know when I may use them for one of my YouTube inboxes or even the members-only Q&As that I do on YouTube. Although I do try to keep those to the member-only questions. But we do a lot of mailbag-type stuff. We'll be doing even more of it again once the history stuff dies down in a couple of months. So get those emails on in. And again, if you want to become a channel member on the YouTube channel, I didn't mention that before, but go over to youtube.com/thesolomonster. You'll see the join button. You can get some perks as part of your membership and bonus content, retro audio that is not accessible to anyone else, anywhere else. I appreciate everybody who did become a member these last couple of weeks. Got a big night coming up. Money in the Bank, of course. I will be live on YouTube immediately after the pay-per-view. Big contest. Still time if you're listening to this. And it's not yet 8 p.m. Eastern on Sunday. Go to WrestleRumble.com. It's $1 to enter the Solomonster Championship replica belt giveaway. One custom Solomonster belt to one lucky winner. Only two of these have been made. I own one. You could own the other. 9 pounds of silver could be yours. I'm going to pick the winner at random live during my Money in the Bank stream tonight. And also, don't forget the AEW All Out ticket contest. Deadline for that is Wednesday at 8 p.m. And then during my Dynamite stream on Wednesday night, I'm going to pick one winner who gets two tickets. Pretty damn good tickets, too. To All Out in Chicago at the, I think it's the Now Arena. It used to be the Sears Center. Now it's the Now Arena, I think it's called. Including food and drink. So if you want to win two tickets to All Out, you got to enter the contest and then tune in on Wednesday night. We'll be back next Sunday for episode 714 of The Solomonster Sounds Off. So until then, be well. Stay safe. I will see you for Money in the Bank tonight. And for 7:14 next Sunday, July 25th. Until then, adios.
The Solo Monster sounds off.
What is the point of Tony Schiavone even coming down to the ring to do these interviews if every single time they pull the microphone out of his hand? There were a couple of AEW diehards who got very upset. Oh my God, you're criticizing. But these will be the first fucking people. If WWE did something like this, oh, they'd be online. Oh my God, WWE, look at this. What a shit product. God forbid you say something negative about AEW. Holy shit. The world is just falling down all around us. You people gotta cool your jets. Don't tell me what to tweet on my Twitter. You can go fuck yourself.
The Solo Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for sound off extras and more. And follow The Solo Monster on Twitter @SoloMonster.
Solo Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solo Monster sounds off.